The series finale of Mad Men is over, but we are just getting started here on Post Show Recaps. Hello, everyone. My name is Mike Bloom, and I am joined by a person who just came back from his own trip to the West Coast and hopefully found himself along the way, Jeremiah Panhorse. Jeremiah, how are you doing today?
I'm doing wonderful, Mike. How you doing, buddy?
Good. You come back with any big ideas for things you want to do now that you're back from the West Coast?
Oh, I've got some commercials in my head right now, my friend. I had an enlightenment. I was sitting in the mountains of California, and just something came to me, and I'm ready to start selling these commercials.
Fantastic. Fantastic. I think that's what Mad Men teaches us all, right, is that we should all be Don Draper, right? That's the moral?
I think so. Yeah. Why not?
Yeah, right? Everyone should just quit being a doctor. Screw it. We don't need doctors. We need ad men.
So get
onto Madison Avenue, start buying lobsters. That's where you're needed.
Exactly. The only thing I'm trying to come up with is what item in the refrigerator would I be that's in there waiting for someone to take me off the shelf? That's what I'm trying to figure out. I'm going to think about going with something exciting that everyone wants, you know, like leftover pizza. Mm-hmm. You know, that to me, if I have leftover pizza in the refrigerator, I think people will, when they open up that refrigerator, be like, yes, leftover pizza. You know, it's much better than something undesirable. You know, you don't want to be that one desirable.
I like to hope I'm like the bottle of sriracha, and that there are certain people that are like, oh, this guy goes great on everything.
There you go.
That's my hope. I'm sure I'm not so much the sriracha as much as I am like the bottle of Dijon mustard that people have to use when they run out of regular mustard.
Yeah, when you look at it, go, oh no.
All right, I guess I'll use this. I'm hoping for the sriracha, probably the Dijon mustard. But here we are. We apologize for the lateness. The time we're recording this is a week after the series finale of Mad Men ended, but because of Jeremiah's pilgrimage to the West, much like Don Draper, we had to push things back. But I think it sort of worked out to our advantage here, because in the 7 days that have followed the Mad Men finale, there have been so many think pieces and articles and interviews that have come out, and it's really helped kind of formulate our thoughts and make them more solid as to towards what the finale is, because there's a lot to talk about. And throughout this discussion of the finale, we're also going to try to talk in discussions about the final season as well, since the last time Jeremiah and I got together was all the way back in the old days of April 2015, when we were talking about the first episode, Severance, of the latter half of season 7. Now, Jeremiah, I'll just start with general thoughts here. Finale, like it, love it, kind of don't like it, hate it. What are your general opinions on it?
Well, I think if you tackle it a second time or more, I think you're going to learn to enjoy it and appreciate it even more. And I think that probably goes for a lot of episodes, including finales. But I, you know, at first I kind of had some mixed feelings, and I think a lot of it has to do with emotions, you know, especially when you have been so tightly covering a show like I have with Mad Men. It's kind of a very surreal moment for me, because, you know, this show has meant so much and I've delved so deep into these characters and what they're all about. To see it come to an end, it was so hard no matter how it ended. So at first I really kind of struggled about it. And then, you know, after like going through it again and really reflecting on it, I really think that it's a beautiful finale myself. I know that a lot of people struggle with some of the ambiguous stuff about it. And when I think, to me, I thought it was a little more clear than other people, but I could certainly see how a lot of people walked away from that. But to me, I there's always going to be some things that I probably could say, yeah, maybe I would have done things a little bit differently there. But to me, I thought it was very, very elegant. And I really thought, I still feel like it sticks very well with what we expect from Mad Men. And I'm sure there's people out there who are doubters about that, but to me, I still think it held true to what we can expect from Matthew and his writers. And I just felt like it was just a beautiful way to end it. And I think that's really the way of taking it in right now. You know, I don't know if my mind will change as time goes on, but that's kind of how I'm feeling right now. I'm so emotional about it. You know what I mean? I know it sounds kind of silly to say it about a TV show, but like I said, this show's been a whole lot to me. So to see it come to an end was extremely, extremely hard. I thought it was satisfying. What about yourself? Did you feel like it was a pretty satisfying finale?
For me, it was. Absolutely. Because I don't know. I don't want to generalize the public, but part of me feels that you know, with a lot of the recent series finales, you know, Breaking Bad is a big instance that I'm thinking of. I think some people want, like, I don't want to say action-packed, but they want, like, something to happen in their finales. And from, what I've, from what I've been reading, I think one of the main complaints people have is they're like, well, John just went back into that business after all this soul-searching. But I think, and we're gonna definitely going to talk about the ending in a lot of detail. But I personally feel like, you know, I for me, it's I'm one of those people that it's much more about the journey than the destination. So I was personally really fine that, like, you know, Don ended up going back to the advertising business, and that there were small changes within characters, but there wasn't any, like, big events. You know, there were no, like, offices closed. You know, there wasn't, like, you know, if I, maybe some people would have been happy if the series had ended with the Sterling Cooper Partners office closing and going to McCann Erickson. But I feel like, again, this is a character centric show. The show is never functioning around certain plot points and action points. So I would say, in, if in terms of resolving certain character points, I thought that they were done very, very well across the board. And we're going to go into a lot of detail here about each character specific arcs over the final season. But I thought it was very well done. And I really enjoyed the journey that everybody took. And I mean, I think some people disparage it a little bit because they say, like, oh, it was a little too rom-com-y. It was a little too sappy sweet. But I was reading one of the interviews that I read was one with John Hamm after the finale. And he said that, like, I think Matthew Weiner gave a quote that at some point, quote, I just want my characters to be a little more happy than they were in the beginning. And I think if you go into the finale with that sort of lens and you see that final montage that I'm sure we're going to talk about, I think the, he succeeded in that goal, and that's fine. I think we live in an age of TV where I think things are very dark and things tend to be a little more cynical. I mean, let's look at one of the most popular shows on TV right now. Game of Thrones lives exactly in that realm of not everybody. In fact, nearly nobody gets a happy ending in the world of Game of Thrones. So if you look at something like Mad Men, you'll say, like, well, that's a little too schlocky, but I'm okay with that because we weren't meant to come into this and be like, this is the most hyper realistic show, gritty, gruesome show about Mad Men in the 60s that are possible. You know, we want these people to succeed. So I was fine with these, with these happy endings for a lot of characters. And I think, I mean, just watching, and I was also, I'm sure we'll talk about this, I was also a fan of Don's little pilgrimage out west. I know I was talking to Rob Cesternino about this at some point, and I don't believe he was a fan of taking Don out of the office, but I really enjoyed the journey that it kind of put him on, culminating in this final breakdown of his character and really shedding off all these coats that he's been, the fur coats that he's been putting on for the past several years, and even in the time we've seen him on the show. And it's, it, we finally got to see Dick Whitman at his core, and it was fantastic to have him exposed like that. Was it lessening to have him go back to McCann Erickson? I'm sure we'll talk about that. But even just to see that character break down was so poignant to me that it made the entire episode worth it.
Yeah, exactly. I actually had the same similar conversation with Rob as well. And I can certainly understand why there was definitely going to be people out there that maybe had some issues with it. But I agree with you. I think it was important for Don's character. And I think it was obviously, you know, this was deliberately written this way for a reason. And I think that Don needed that to get to a place in his life to kind of understand things so much more. And I mean, obviously that final scene with the Leonard character, which I know we're going to talk a lot about, I think, you know, all that led up to something very important for Don to get to that point in his life where he can kind of realize what he's saying. Cause this is a story about life. I mean, this is about life's journeys and the little ups and downs and even the big moments, the little moments that all of us go through. And I know maybe sometimes people don't think of that being exciting television, but that's what Mad Men really is all about. And it's like you said, it's not plot driven. It's about the characters, and that's really what we really needed to come to me. That's what was important is to come with is at least have a feeling of where those characters at the time. And since the goal was at least to make them feel, like you said, a little bit happier than they were when we first met them, I think you could definitely, you know, besides Betty, of course, but even Betty, I think was able to really understand.
I would argue that Betty's.
I was just going to say, I do think that Betty did come to realization of what life was about and understood things and was able to face her demise much better than maybe Betty would have if she would have had this happen to her, you know, when the show first started. So, yeah, I think that there's plenty of growth with everybody. And I do think that they're at least felt like they're all in a good spot.
Yeah.
When it ended. And I think that's perfect. I think that's the way Mad Men should end.
Yeah. I always put it to my friends that one of the things I absolutely love about Mad Men is that nothing really happens in most episodes of Mad Men, but you're so captivated by everything. And that is extremely hard to pull off with a TV show. And I'm sure we'll talk at the end about the legacy of Mad Men, but that's something that it's carried with it all the way to the end of its days. You know, again, some people say that nothing happened in the Mad Men finale. Okay, that could be argued for. But at the same time, nothing really has happened in Mad Men in general. You know, there were a couple of deaths here and there. People have gotten fired and transferred jobs, but there's hasn't really been giant life-altering events, you know? But that's the point of it, is that we're watching these characters just kind of stand on an airport treadmill and watch as different life events kind of pass them by, and we're on the treadmill next to them.
Yeah, that's a great way to describe it.
So let's start moving through our discussion of the finale here. And
as we
get to certain characters, I think we can definitely stop and talk about their arcs in general in the final season. Jeremiah, did you notice there's obviously a lot of fan service being paid from AMC to the show because it's sort of its first child in terms of, I think maybe Breaking Bad has kind of become and The Walking Dead have kind of been like the hotter commodities overall in terms of viewership.
Right,
but I think Mad Men has been, it's more critical darling. And there's a nice little like montage to begin with. I will say the one thing that I really enjoyed about this, there was a song, and I think one of the lyrics was like, the good times and the bad you see. And as it was saying that, it was cutting to that one scene where Zooby Zooby Zoo happened. And I'm like, oh, that's a perfect representation of how people thought about that moment.
Yeah, I agree. That was great. That was really great. Yeah, this really was, though, AMC's baby. I mean, you know, despite, like you said, the huge success that Breaking Bad had and the huge success that obviously Walking Dead is having and still having, is that I don't think we would have never been at the point, even though Breaking Bad came around, you know, close around the same time. But Mad Men is the one that put AMC on the map, you know, and it's the one that was a show that people obviously started to take this station seriously as far as developing a very, very awesome television. And it's their baby. And I love the montage that the long goodbyes that we've had for Mad Men, which has been really great. And I totally understand why they would do that, because like I said, this is it. This was their baby. This is the one that really put them on the map.
So we open here and Don is driving speeding cars through the desert in Utah. Is that right? Is he trying to like work with guys to break the land speed record or something? It was very ambiguous to me.
It was. I think it's just Don. You know, he's on this road trip, and he's obviously at this point he has no car, so he's just kind of going wherever. And I'm sure it sounds like he kind of heard about the story about them breaking that land record and decided, yeah, I'm going to get on a bus and go there, you know. And he ran into these guys and just started racing cars with them, you know. It's just, like I said, Don just trying to meet new people and experience new things or on this little journey he's going through. And I'm sure, like I said, he probably heard about that and decided, I'm going to go there.
Yeah. You know? And maybe we can take this time to kind of discuss the Don's pilgrimage storyline, because I mean, it's interesting. And I think I read this in the interview with Matthew Weiner after the finale, that he talks about that he realizes he was writing it, that Don really just loves strangers. Like that's the thing that he really thrives in, is trying to convince a stranger to buy something or to convince a stranger into buy in something he's pitching. So I think one of the things that I loved many things about the pilgrimage, and one of them for me was he gets to interact with the people that he wants to. I mean, granted, it was initially spurred on by the fact that he wanted to go find Diana, the waitress, and thinks that she may have been back where her ex-husband was. But also, in addition to that, you know, again, I'm talking about shedding these various fur coats into exposing who Dick Whitman is at the end of the day, and that in that phone booth in the middle of the retreat. I think as he's moving through here, he's slowly shedding off layers. You know, when he goes to the veterans headquarters or hall or whatever it is, and he goes into that story about, you know, how he basically he admits how he took. You know, how Don, the actual Don Draper died, though I don't think he didn't throw in there that he ended up taking his identity, but he told him what this, he told him what the story was and how he felt guilted about it, and he sort of got to kind of, you know, admit to somebody about that for the first time in a very, very, very long time. And he gets he got to finally, you know, he tried to find solace in the Draper household, and Stephanie kind of pushed him away, so he's able to unfurl that as well. So one of the things I really loved about this pilgrimage is that, like, whether forcefully or on purpose, Don is slowly unraveling the, this visage that, even though we've seen him at low points over the past seven seasons, we haven't really seen him where he is now, where he's just on the road completely on his own with people he has never met before that are really exposing him for who he is. And as a result, that's very jarring to him. Did you have any thoughts about Don's whole journey through the past, what, like three, four episodes of the season?
Yeah, I mean, okay, so the way I looked at it was, is that Don, you know, you think about Don and the influence he's had in his life. I think that there was a reason why we were able to see that moment with Don back in the early season of season one with the Hobo Code, when he meets this hobo and he has this moment with him. He talks about how, you know, he's just out on the road and he's meeting different people every day, and how it makes that he was able, like, he's at a relaxing moment where he could sleep like a stone every night. And yeah, he maybe didn't know where he was going to get his next meal, but to him, that was exciting. And because Don likes, like you said, strangers, and he likes the beginning of things. And I think part of that's because is that once, I think Don gets afraid that once he gets to know someone long enough, that maybe he will be disappointed in something. And that if, when you first meet someone, it's all exciting and new, and you don't, you just learn, maybe I just met this person, and you don't, you know, you haven't had that chance yet to be disappointed. And with Don, you know, he loves that idea. And I think this was, to him, I think he would just kind of wanted to shed all that and, like, kind of live that hobo life for a moment, you know, and hopefully maybe find something that he was obviously been looking for forever, which is, you know, the meaning of things. And I think that this nice moment on the road really was able to do that. And like you said, he's able to open up to new people and new experiences and things like that. And I think, of course, as we could tell by the finale, it was leading us up to that moment where he got to hear something really important he's always wanted to hear, that there's other people out there that kind of feel the same way he does when it comes to life and love and the meaning of things. And I just think it was extremely important for him. And I thought it was really opening moment for Don's life. And I think it really was extremely important for us to kind of close with that as him going on this trip and figuring things out.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And so it's interesting to me that again, it's all spurred by him. And we talked about this in the very first episode with where Diana, the waitress, appeared, with him trying to kind of chase after this past entity and him trying to find, quote unquote, the good old days, so he can kind of immerse himself on that and not really think about the present or the future. But then when he goes there and tries to do that, it's immediately thrown in his face when her ex-husband's basically like, she's moved on, get away from her. And as a result, and we see, you know, like you said, you bring up the hobo code actually really interestingly, because he's about to drive back to New York when that hitchhiker gets in his car, and I think he says he's going to, like, Minnesota. And that's when Don makes the choice to just not go back to New York. And that could speak very much to the hobo code, and it could also speak very much to, like, all right, yeah, I'm not going to look back on the past. Great. That's a great idea. My past is all in New York. I'm just going to head for the coast and see what happens.
Right, exactly. And in that episode, the first episode, well, after, of course, he has that moment where we could clearly say, okay, maybe he's not going to go back to New York. And then the next episode, of course, is titled The Milk and Honey Route, which is actually referencing to a piece that, you know, a professor had done, or a doctor or whatever he was, a psychologist, that studied about the hobo life, you know. And I just think that's, I mean, obviously Don is not he's a lot different than a normal hobo, you know, because, you know, he has a Cadillac and a lot of money
for like the next like three episodes.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, but he's living a very similar life, you know. He just keeps on going. He doesn't matter what he has on him or what he's got with him. I mean, that moment in this episode, in the finale, where he's like so drunk that when those guys show up to come and get him, and he could barely get in there, and he was just like, he grabbed his envelope of money and said, I'm ready to go, you know, because he's
was that Mike Holloway? They made an appearance. I didn't know he appeared on the Mad Men finale.
Well, you know, I think that Don, when he's really drunk, he could eventually sound like Mike Holloway.
Well, I say Mike Holloway has $1 million now. He could very much take a John Draper lifestyle and just hitchhike across America.
Yeah, he should. I met him. I should have told him that he should just hit the road in a Cadillac and go see the world, man.
Yeah, just bring a nice bucket of scorpions to munch on and he'll be good to go.
Yeah, exactly.
Can we talk Diana briefly, just because I think that connects there. And this is one of the things of the final season that got kind of left behind. Mm-hmm. This is one of the things where the final season kind of dropped the ball for me. Just because I might be reflecting the opinions of a lot of people in the media when they said this as well. But I didn't understand why she was introduced for, like, you know, I think it's weird to begin with to introduce a character in its final season. Just because as a default, you want to think like, okay, final season, we're going to be with these characters that we've been with the entire time. Two, I mean, just as a Don fan, I didn't necessarily want to see him just like keep going back to her and, you know, really investing in her when it's clear like she does not want anything to do with him. So that was just my personal frustration with Diana the Waitress. But Jeremiah, it sounds like you might be a little more keen on Diana than I might be.
Well, no, I think no, I'm actually very close to the same boat as everyone else is concerned. I mean, I have never been a huge fan about, you know, introducing too many new characters in the last, especially, you know, in the last, you know, 6 or 7 episodes, because, you know, it's like, I don't want to get vested too much. Now, I know that Matthew mentioned in his big interview with A.M. Holmes that, you know, he found it very fascinating that a lot of people were writing about this, that they were frustrated with the fact that we were introducing new characters. And he, of course, the typical Matthew Weiner response was, oh, I never thought of it that way, you know. And I'm sure, you know, there's an importance there with the character, but I do struggle with that importance because I think I kind of are. I mean, to me, Don looked at her as, you know, like someone who is extremely broken like himself. Right. And I get that. And I'm sure maybe he kind of felt like he saw himself in her and he wanted to be with her because of that, I suppose. But since, you know, it looks like from what we can tell, you know, obviously maybe Don's never going to be with her. So it's very frustrating, I think, for us fans to kind of wonder, well, then, you know, how important was it for us to really get to meet this woman and get to know about how, you know, just getting to know her deep past history there. And, you know, how does that really relate to Don Draper? How do you feel about this? Because I do kind of do struggle a little bit with that. I just don't know if it was necessarily important for me to know, because I certainly didn't learn anything new about Don Draper by his interaction with Diana. Did you learn anything new?
No, except just the fact that he was chasing after the past. But I mean, I guess that would be the only thing, just because I think we've seen even in up until the end of season 6, when he takes Sally to the whorehouse where he was raised. And I think he's been kind of running away from the past. So it was interesting, at least, to see him for the first couple of episodes try to chase that past feeling down. And especially after Rachel Menken died and he kind of equated Diana's likeness to Rachel. But then once they kind of kept her around, once she became a more significant character, I think then I was like, the worm turned a little bit for me. And I'm like, oh,
okay.
Why are they concentrating so much on her?
That's how I felt too. Absolutely. If it would have just been for that moment to kind of, like you said, reflect on the whole Rachel thing and that, you know, the things that you know, he feels maybe he missed there. And, you know, like maybe I see, because it's not like all of a sudden we think that Diana's going to be that replacement for Rachel. And it was once, like you said, took a further route there as we went on with the season. I think you're right. I think that's kind of where I had my issues with it as well. Yeah. It's not an issue where it ruins the final half of season 7 for me necessarily, but I certainly think every time it comes about, I think I'm always going to struggle a little bit with it. But who knows? Maybe this is, again, is something that even takes us a little bit more time for us to reflect even more on it. But right now, my feelings, even a week later, are still kind of frustrated a little bit with that.
Yeah. Now, I would usually probably skip over this Roger and Meredith and the two secretaries scene, but I know you've talked with Meredith in an interview, right, Jeremiah?
Yes, I did. Yes, I've talked to Stephanie Drake. She's a sweet, sweet lady. So I know where you're going to go with this. Is what's going to happen to Merida, right?
I mean, did you think that was a fun send off of her? Because I think the fun thing about Meredith is that, like, she does seem very ditzy on the surface, but she has these moments of kind of clarity. And one of them is in this scene, you know, where she says she hopes Don is in a better place, and Roger says he's not dead, and she says, well, any place is better than here. And I think that's kind of a resounding statement for basically how all the Sterling Cooper people feel about working at McCann. So as someone who has talked with her before, do you think like she had a fun farewell?
I kind of felt that way. I mean, I haven't had a chance to go back and talk to her, you know, personally, but I have a feeling that from what I've kind of gathered from some of the things she said online, I think she was very satisfied with it, you know. And I do think that, like she said, when she said, well, you know, hope you land on your feet, and she goes, I always will, or I always do. And I do. I think that Merida is one of those kind of people. She does find a way to land on her feet. You know, I'm sure a lot of people are wondering, well, you know, if Don did come back to work to McCann, does that mean that Merida gets her job back? And I don't know, maybe. But I think by that point, you know, I think she's kind of maybe moved on. I'm sure she'll find something. But
yeah, I mean, and then let's remember that Don did a very similar thing, where I think when she found out what was going on, she was one of the people that said, like, no, thanks, I'm going my own way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I agree. So I think that, personally for myself, I think Meredith had a good ending there. And I do think that Stephanie, from what I could tell, was pleased with it. And I mean, let's be honest, a character that we barely knew much about, but, you know, season 7 was a big season for Meredith, and she really came into her own, and she was very delight. I mean, lots of comic relief for us for the entire season 7 came with Meredith, I thought. So yeah,
very, very much so. And there wasn't too much to be found, even with Roger, who's usually the big comic relief. I think he was undergoing his own things that didn't make him necessarily the funniest people. So when you have these people, like, you know, you have a Meredith, or you have like a Mrs. Blankenship back when she was still alive, like those are the characters that are still fun to have around.
Yeah, they're very important. Especially for a show like Mad Men, I think it's very important. You definitely have to have those characters, because they're essential, I really think.
Jeremiah, I want to talk a little bit about badass Peggy, because we're going to get to romantic Peggy later on. But I think in this next scene in the show is the one where, you know, her and Stain got taken off of this like Chevalier account, and she ends up kind of strong arming that one woman, Lorraine, into giving her the account back. And I think that's a giant reflection of the conversation that her and Roger have. Is it the previous episode or the episode beforehand, where, you know, her and Roger are still at the Sterling Cooper offices, and they kind of have a conversation, and it culminates in this amazing shot of Peggy walking into McCann with her sunglasses on and a cigarette and just strutting her stuff, which is so like not Peggy. It's absolutely amazing. So I kind of want to use this scene as a microcosm to kind of reflect on a larger sense of like, what did you think about Peggy's specific work arc this entire little half season?
Yeah, I'm so glad you mentioned it, because that scene right there, and of course she doesn't take no for answer, and she basically kind of like forces the hand for this woman, and I don't even know if we even know that character's name, but this woman who's running the meeting. Was it okay? And she's basically saying, yeah, let's go talk to him, let's go see what he feels about this. And she's able to kind of like just, you know, manhandle herself into getting what she wants. And, you know, I think those are just those little nuggets that we were getting right away to let us know that she's taking that advice, she's running with it, and she's going to get what she wants eventually. You know, I mean, I don't know if it really is going to take her to 1980 to become creative director, but she's going to get there. And I remember when we were watching it the first time out, what I wrote my notes when that scene happened was I reminded myself again that Peggy is going to be okay. That's what I wrote. Peggy is going to be okay, because she is a badass, right? I mean, you know,
yeah, basically.
Now, granted, yeah, basically, she's a badass. She did have cats. You know, I know it was Halloween. She had some cats covering up the octopus painting, but she still got the painting there. And I just think that we're led to show you that this woman who has worked so hard to get where she's at, and she is going to be just fine. For anyone who was worried about whether or not Peggy really is going to make it, there's no doubt in my mind that she has. And this sign of this badass side of Peggy Olson, this is where she's at. This is the place she's at in her life. And it was just so awesome to watch. And I just, of course, I'm a huge Peggy fan. So I could go on and on about how much I love her. But yeah, I really, when I saw that scene, that's exactly what I was reminded of, is that she's going to rock it.
Yeah.
She's going to be just fine, McCann. She is not going to take any crap from anybody.
Yeah. And she has, I mean, that's, I think that's the big thing to reflect of, is her certainty. And it also harkens back to a scene when the deals were kind of being brokered, when she meets with that guy and she says, like, you know, okay, what are my options for my career path? Where should I go? And he says, well, you should go to McCann Erickson. And she's like, I don't want to do that. And he basically convinces her that, like, look, if you stay in McCann, you can leverage yourself a job into anything you want to do, basically. And I think Peggy is slowly trying to figure out, you know, like, basically except for her tiny bit of time at Ted's old company, she's basically lived her professional life with the Sterling Cooper people. And I think moving on to this much larger company is something that scared her a little bit. But I think between this guy advising her and Roger's words to her, I think she realized, like, I am not a doormat. And I think she's been, specifically in the first couple seasons, she was such a doormat you know, when she was a secretary, and then even when she started working creative and you had people walking all over her. And I think the Peggy that walked into McCann on that first day is not going to be a doormat. And I think that's makes me really excited. I'm also really excited to see if Peggy does become creative director of, like, 1980. I want to see her with, like, the perm and, like, the, the shoulder pads. Like, I want to see, like, total, like, working girl-esque Peggy.
Yeah, I mean, I know obviously we're never going to see that, but I've got it visualized in my head that that's exactly how she's going to be, and it would be awesome to see, wouldn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. let's fly a little south, Jeremiah. Let's go to Key West for, like, a hot sec, right?
Okay, that's
I got some stuff for you. Richard gave it to me. It's some good stuff. I feel like someone has just given me very good news. That's how good I feel about this stuff.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you know, I don't think I've had any of that kind of good stuff before. Oh, wait, no, I know I haven't had that kind of good stuff before. But what an interesting way to describe it.
Yeah, that's probably the best way of, I mean, I hope that no kids were watching that, because that might be one of the most enticing arguments for drugs that I've heard on television.
I was gonna say, that is almost like a great commercial for it. You know, like, go ahead and try it. It'll make you feel like you just got good news.
Yeah. If Joan had been able to pitch that, if Holloway, you know, Harris Productions had been able to pitch that, like, 20 years ago when they were still, or a while ago when they were still putting, like, Coke and Coca-Cola, and when it was still being used as, like, a dental product, like, she could have made millions on it.
Yeah, exactly. Now, the first question I have for you about that particular scene was, I think most, I know all of us, that we were watching it together, we all looked at each other and go, oh my God, no, don't tell me the two of them are going to become junkies. And we were going to have some flash.
You've been watching too much of The Wire, Jeremiah.
I think so. I know. But, you know, when you have particular characters that you're so tied up in and you care about, the last thing you want to do is see them start taking cocaine and then think, oh no, where is this going to lead for them?
Yeah, you know? It's weird. We actually, outside of, like, Freddie Rumsen, we really haven't had many characters have huge addictions, you know, or at least if they have, they haven't long gone through withdrawal or anything. You know, we haven't seen someone try to quit smoking cold turkey and then go through all these different pains and flop sweats. Adana's had flop sweats for different reasons, but I don't think we've ever had anyone, like, actually turn into junkies, which is weird because, like, I feel like they definitely could have. Drugs were rampant at that time and everyone was just taking them just because.
Absolutely. It certainly was. I mean, you know, the 60s was kind of the birth of a lot of that stuff. You know, I mean, you can make a fair argument that it was the birth of a lot of that stuff. But I certainly agree. I mean, they've obviously dealt more probably with alcohol than anything else, which makes a lot of sense. I mean, because a lot of the characters dealt with that. I mean, Don Draper especially has gone through a lot when it comes to his abuse of alcohol. But yeah, I'm kind of surprised they haven't dealt too much in it. Maybe it's because, you know, I guess the harder drugs really did come about even more as we moved on, especially into the 70s and things like that. So maybe that was a subject that they felt like really was going to work, but we all know it was going on and there was definitely plenty of people doing it already. So it would have been too much out of the realm to see someone become a junkie. But, you know, after that scene though, I still stopped and think to myself, well, of course this is not going to happen with Joan, because Joan is too strong of a woman to get caught up into something like this. In fact, she even makes the comment to Richard that, you know, you're such a bad influence for me, you know, and just kind of joking around about that. So she's not going for her. That was just a fun little quick thing to do. And then I can't imagine her ever touching it again.
Yeah. She doesn't become like Tony Montana.
No, exactly. So I have no concerns that was going to be, but it was just for a shining moment, you know, of like, oh no, I hope she's not going to turn into junkie.
That would be really, I think I might have problems with the finale if it leads to Joan becoming a coke addict.
Oh my God. I think the whole world, could you imagine how many hate letters they would have gotten if that happened?
Oh my God. But so we spoke about Diana as one of the new characters that was introduced, but she's not the only one. Richard was another one that was introduced for only these 7 episodes. What is your opinion on Richard?
I think Richard was a plot point to show us the fact that Joan is at a point in her life where she is still, she's not, despite all the success she's had already, she's still not satisfied, you know, that she had, there's so much more she wants in her career, and she loves it and she craves it. And that even though a lot of us probably always thought, well, we just want to see Joan settle down with a really nice guy like Rich would have been a perfect person in a lot of people's eyes for her, right? I mean, he seemed to be sweet. He definitely seemed to care about her. He wanted to like run away and have this amazing life with her, doing amazing things, seeing amazing places, going amazing places, doing all these things, which would have been beautiful ending for her, right? I mean, I would have been perfectly fine if Joan felt like, okay, I've done enough in my life and my career that I'm ready to just, you know, relax and hang out with this guy and raise Kevin and, you know, just live a great life. I would have been cool with that. I would have totally been satisfied with that. But I think what was great about this is that this relationship reminded us that that's not where she's at in her life right now, you know? And obviously the two of them were on two different paths, you know? He was done with all that and she is not. And I think that's why we got to see this relationship blossom a little bit, was to remind us that she's not ready for that part of her life yet. She's still wanting to be kick-ass Joan, and she's ready to just, you know, take on the world still and create something special, and obviously create something for herself. Mm-hmm. So I think that was just there. That relationship was there to lead us to that, to lead us to a point to remind us that that's where Joan is at in her life right now. So how did you feel? Did you have a problem with it? Because I didn't have a problem with the Richard thing too much.
No, I mean, I personally think that he almost seems like Diana to me in terms of, I think he represents something. I agree with you. I think Richard helped Joan realize what she wanted, because I think for a while we've seen Joan juggle like, do I want a more prominent career position? Do I want to find a man who I'll stay with the rest of my life? And I think Richard was someone to present to her, I'm a person that will take care of you for the rest of your life. And it sort of made Joan realize, oh no, I actually just, I want to be more concentrated in my work, which is actually parallels Peggy's story really nicely in terms of she almost is taking the Peggy role, becoming the workaholic. That being said, I mean, I think sort of like Diana, I don't know if, I think he may have outstayed his welcome a little bit. I think I'm okay with him being in the finale, because I think having Joan ultimately make that decision to pick up the phone was very important. But I don't know if we needed him for like those like 3-4 episodes, you know. But I guess if you had to like build a relationship between them, I don't know. So again, I think in terms of like on paper as a character, I think he's very important. Having him on there, I'm like, okay, I get it. But maybe you didn't need to be so centric to what was going on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I totally get that. I guess then that maybe, you know, and I don't want to go back to the, you know, thing at all, but I think that to me, this is a good example of the fact that I am able to myself see that the Richard relationship was there for a reason, to remind us of something that Joan really needed in her life, that, you know, there's a reason for it. And I just, again, I still don't know what that is for the Don and Diana thing. What did Don learn from the Diana thing that made him like go, oh, this is what I need, you know? And we didn't get that.
I think Don learned not to give $100 tips.
Yeah, exactly.
That's the lesson that he learned.
Don't give strange waitresses at a diner $100, because you never know what's going to lead to, right? Yeah.
Let's talk some Campbell here, Jeremiah, because Pete was very much missing from the finale. He sort of had his big wrap up the episode before. So I think let's give Mr. Campbell his due, since I think we both really, really love him as a character. This is so much in line with what Matthew Weiner was talking about before. If I want my characters to be a little more happy than they were in the beginning, Pete got one of the happiest endings as someone who it feels like he's living in the shadow of everyone he works with and is barely recognized for the work he does. I think it's the happiest ending he could ever get to A, reunite with his family, and B, to have a job where he is recognized and is now living the high life. Did you like the way Pete's story ended?
Well, I think it's going to be no surprise that knows me well, knows that I was obviously very satisfied with the ending for Pete Campbell, because I kind of wanted the guy. I know he's a creep. I get that. And I'm sure I'll hear people constantly will remind me that I can't believe you like him. But I think that is that he kind of represent a lot for me, because, and I know I talked about this with Sessionino as well, that, you know, he's that guy that, you know, he's not Don Draper where everything he, you know, in life kind of comes to him. You know, he really has to work for it, and things don't always work out for him very well. So I love the fact that he kind of had his awakening, like you said in the previous episode, where he had this moment where he realized, you know, why am I still searching for something better? Why am I trying to be like my father, who he clearly didn't like? You know, why am I trying to be like this guy? Why am I trying to be like him, where I'm always wanting something better? Why I always think there's something to be something better, which of course has been a long theme about this show, is what, you know, what else is there? And he finally realized, you know, I already had something. I have something great here with Trudy and Tammy. And why am I keep doing this? And then when this opportunity opens up for him to take this job, he's able to run with it and make this new life for him. And hopefully we're at least left with the impression that maybe he's changed enough to where he can now be that wonderful husband and father that he's maybe always wanted to be, but just never able to open up to it and stop looking for other things. And I thought it was delightful. And I love that final scene too, with the two of them getting on the airplane and on the Learjet, and the hair flowing, the wind, and he's grabbing Tammy and the car, and you could just see them riding off to be the kings of Wichita now. So I thought it was beautiful. I really enjoyed it. What about yourself?
Yeah, I love it, because it's also sort of a culmination of, I believe that Pete throughout basically the whole series is trying to emulate Don. You know, we even see we even see it with this whole storyline with like his driving school, and when he's trying to hit on that girl, he's trying to fancy himself as like Don Draper. And of course he is the worst Don Draper version ever, because nothing ever works out for him. And as a result, he basically has this whole family breakdown, and he ends up in kind of this career slump. So I think, again, I'm going to use this shedding the fur coat metaphor once more. I think once he's kind of able to shed that and realize, like, I do not want to be that person, you know, when he's talking to his brother, who is kind of living that Don Draper lifestyle, and he says, like, you don't want to do that. I think once he realizes that, he says, like, you know what? Maybe I should move out to Kansas. I don't need to be living this lifestyle, this New York ad man who's alone and miserable about everything, you know, and he lost his didn't he lose his like real estate girlfriend at the beginning of the first half of the season, because he was like had to visit his daughter or something? So
yes,
it's clear that like
she didn't like New York, Pete.
Yeah. So like, I think once he sort of had that realization, I mean, as cheesy as that whole come to Jesus moment with Trudy was last episode, where he says, like, you know, we can be happy, we can get back together. I thought that was really sweet. And I mean, I love Allison Brie and everything she does, so it's great to have her have a happy ending as well. So I'm bidding a nice fond adieu to the Campbell family. And I'm glad that he was at least able to find some solace, considering how under the thumb he was the entire series we've seen him.
Yeah, and I tell, if anybody who struggles if Pete really is in the right spot for this, like you said, go back to the conversation he has with his brother in that episode. And I think that to me is enough of a sign of where Pete Campbell is in his head. And I think he's ready for this.
Yeah, absolutely. Talking specifically about the scene he had with Peggy, first of all, we get a nice Harry. I think Harry's final moment on the show is everyone ignoring him, which, as much as I talk about Pete Campbell being under the thumb, I think I'm okay with having Harry Crane be under the thumb, because I think that's kind of a joke.
Yes.
But they have their own little goodbye moment, and you sort of forget that their history is so rich as well, especially considering the first couple of seasons. And I mean, he gives her the cactus. Now, as we know, Mad Men is an extremely symbolic show, and everything, every piece of music, every object is in the show for a reason. Did you have any sort of significance that you could glean from the cactus?
Yeah, I was thinking about that when I was rewatching and thinking about the symbolism of the cactus. You know, I think that, oh boy, you know, their relationship, like you said, is so rich. And so for so long, we wondered about where things would go with them. But I think that now that they're in a place to where they really are truly good friends, you know, and they care a lot about each other, and they appreciate, they understand and appreciate their history between each other. But that that despite all the things they've gone through, that they're at a good place now. And I did think it was a sweet gesture, you know, about what the cactus thing. And I also too love how he said that, you know, when I come back, expect that to be alive, which I thought was really beautiful too. I don't know, like, how that references necessarily cactus. I haven't had a chance to, I have not had a chance to read anything about what other people were saying about the cactus, but I did think that that whole scene was just a really wonderful moment. And I, of course, love how she uses his line about a thing like that. I just thought it was really, really nice. And I'm going to be a very favorable to a lot of these things that I know some people struggle with, because I am a bit of a sentimental guy. And so I kind of enjoyed those kinds of scenes. And so for me, I had absolutely no problem with it, but yeah, I just thought it was really beautiful, the way they did that. So hit me with it. How's your feelings about that? Especially with the way it symbolizes with the cactus. Where did you come with it?
I mean, I looked up some stuff about cactus because I believe this is going to be such a musical theater nerd thing. And the musical Kiss Me, Kate, I believe there is a reference to giving someone a cactus when you like want to break up with, like when you want to like break up with them. But I also checked somewhere that like giving someone a cactus symbolizes like their enduring love for you. And maybe, okay. And maybe we can kind of compare this to like the Roger and Joan scene, where I think between both pairs, it's kind of an amicable nod to each other that like, look, something has happened in the past, but we're ready to take like the product that we had, that we created together, and move on. I think with Pete and Peggy, it's much more of a work product than obviously a product of flesh and bone and DNA. But I think it's sort of a reference to each other that like, in spite of how things were very weird to begin with, I think they have grown a really nice friendship, and they'll always have those kind of secrets to hold, and that sort of thing that kind of ties them together no matter what. And again, it's something that we don't really remember because they kind of they've butted heads a couple times, and they even did it in this past half season. But other than that, we don't really see the two of them together anymore, which is a little weird. But I think it was, you know, we talk about how a show's final season likes to make a lot of nods to, you know, season one or old school episodes and characters. And I think this was a key example, just harkening back to really, I mean, the first episode of Mad Men, Peggy's storyline ends with her and Pete doing the, you know, folding down the Murphy bed.
Yes.
Right. So it's nice to establish, to even, you know, establish that. And I think another great line from the scene, again, harkening back to Pete's final moments where he's finally happy, is, you know, Peggy says, you know, Pete lavishes all this praise onto Peggy, which is also something that he doesn't really do, and he does for the first time ever. And she's like, what am I supposed to say to something like that? And he says, I don't know, nobody's ever said it to me. And I think that's just a perfect representation of what Pete Campbell's character was throughout it. So this was a really great scene for me. I would have loved to see more Pete Campbell in the series finale, but he had such great moments in the previous episode that I'm very happy with how he wound up.
Yeah, exactly. And I know a lot of people debated about whether or not we even needed to see Pete, but I felt like you still had to see Pete, even if it was for the brief moments that we had. And obviously that moment with Peggy, I think, was extremely important because it kind of, like you said, brings things back around from the beginning, you know, because they had started this relationship, you know, like you said, conceiving this child together, and they had this moment, you know, where he was immediately from the first episode on, you know, you could tell he had been eyeballing this woman, this new secretary, you know, that has joined up. And that was back when this Pete couldn't even be any more creepier than you know, more of a slime ball at the time. And bring everything back around to seeing where they're at today and, you know, where they're at the end. It was just a great moment to see them. And I'm glad that you were able to have that time to look up the meaning of the cactus, because I know I did not, but I do totally get to see that. And that explains the scene perfectly.
Yeah. So let's talk about the first couple of these phone calls before Don left to go on to his little road trip. Ted Shaw told Don, I think, so he just spat it off, that a man only meets three women in his life. And I think it's no coincidence that Don makes calls to arguably the three most important women in his life.
Yes.
So the first call is to Sally, and this is sort of, he sort of has chuck up calls with Sally throughout, and this starts off as kind of a run of the mill thing of this is where I am. And then she admits to him about what's going on with Betty. And there's an interesting kind of play in this scene where we see that Sally wants to be taken seriously. And obviously she's much more mature about this than Don initially thought. You know, he's the one that says, well, Bobby and Jean obviously have to live with me. And she says, you know, I've given this a lot of thought. You need to convince them to live with Henry. And maybe we can expand this into talk about Sally's arc in general. She had a couple things to do in this half season, but not so much. Maybe we can talk about it more as the final season in general. Have you enjoyed the whole like Sally kind of becoming her own type of woman storyline? And not necessarily, you know, she was a rebellious youth to begin with, even in like seasons 5 and 6. But as we see her coming to the end of this episode, she's become much more of the domestic person, and she seems to be almost taking Betty's place. I would love to hear your thoughts about all of this.
That's exactly how I felt about it, because, you know, we've seen this little girl. She was this sweet little girl when we first saw her in the beginning of the series, and she has now grown into herself to be a very young, obviously she's still very young, but she's young adult, you know, and she's coming of her own, and she really is a extremely independent, smart young lady. She's able to think things through, and I think that that conversation she had with Don was so beautiful, because she's able to say, listen, Dad, you need to listen to me for a moment. Take me seriously here, because I've really thought this through and I really think this is what's best. And I think for all of us that are watching it, we're able to recognize that. And, you know, this is an emotional, you know, news for Don, because he's just hearing about these things. But Sally's had that time to process everything and really think this thing through. And she really wanted him to hear her out. And I thought that, wow, she has come such a long way to that little girl who was putting a, you know, place plastic bag over her head and having her mother not even recognize that that was the dangerous part, except for it was the fact that she put her dress, maybe terrified of where the dress could be, because, you know, God forbid, you know, you'd be worried about your daughter suffocating to death. But she comes so long way from that sweet little girl to where she is today. Mm-hmm. And you're absolutely right. If you would think of anyone who's extremely obviously important in Don's life, of those three women, like you said, that Ted said, Sally has got to be, you know, right in there is number three, you know, number three, or you can even say number one even, but she is extremely important to him. And definitely, obviously, that these three women were completely, this was definitely done on purpose. Oh, yeah. In the way they brought it. But fantastic. The growth of her has been just so fantastic to watch.
Yeah. And I think even though Sally's still a teenager, I think we've seen her sort of shed her fur coat of rebelliousness, at least. And we saw it even earlier in this half season with the return of creepy Glenn, where, you know, Glenn comes back and he says, I'm joining the army. And I think to her, Glenn was such a symbol of, like, you know, buck the system and sort of,
yes,
you know, like the, you know, we need to fight the man, and to have him join the army, even though we find out that he does it for other reasons. I think to her, it represents like, well, maybe it's time to grow up, and then maybe it's time to realize that, like, we just need to live in the structures that we're given. And so to have her kind of go through that, I think has led so much to these final moments. And I agree. I think Sally is such an interesting character in John's life too, because even though Betty was his first wife, I think Sally is the main connection with him to his past with that family, because he doesn't really talk to Betty anymore. And I think talking to Sally constantly, it sort of reminds him of, like, this is the life that I once led. Plus, I mean, if we're talking about incidents that bind people, I mean, Sally was the one that walked in on Don and Sylvia, the neighbor. So, and he even brings it up later when he says, I scandalized my child. I'm assuming that was one of the ways he scandalized his child. But I think, I think that's the moment when Don realizes that, like, oh yeah, the girl that saw that, or the girl that saw, you know, Marie pulling down the Murphy bed for Roger in a way.
Right.
I think that he realizes, like, oh, she is much more mature than I thought she would be.
Yeah, because and she's had to be, because, like you said, when you have someone like a Don Draper as your father, you're going to probably run into some incidents that's going to cause you to have to grow up a lot faster than maybe other kids her age would have to do.
Yeah.
And I think it's kind of helped prepare her too greatly for the challenges that she's going to be facing now when she's going to have to kind of be the mother in these children's life. I mean, and you could see that clearly with these scenes that she had with the kids, and I'm sure you'll probably mention that as well, that we could actually see that she's ready for that role as much as possible that someone her age could be ready for it.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's talk about call number two here. Let's talk about the call to Betty. And it was talked about on Pop Culture Happy Hour this past week, but I'm gonna echo it as well. If anyone thinks that January Jones is not a good actress, and that actually includes myself, watch this last scene between Don and Betty, because this will defy all of your expectations. Because any sort of instances that people thought like, oh yeah, Betty's a boring character, she's so one note, just watch this scene and think about, I mean, now that Betty kind of has no sort of, you know, she's given no F's about everything now that she knows she has 6 months to live, she is so ferocious about the way, and specifically about the way she's talking to Don about like, no, you do not come home. And it's I'll say in general, it's kind of a heartbreaking scene too, because Don wants to go home and he wants to say goodbye to her. And she's basically saying, you can't, I want to keep things as normal as possible. So you need to stay away. And it's pretty, and you could feel his heartbreak on the other end, which, you know, leads to the Utah boys finding him drunk in his room. But this to him is, you know, if we're again talking about him trying to live in the past, this is definitely a symbol to him of like, no, you can never go back to that past.
Oh, absolutely. The finalism of the whole thing was really hitting him hard, I'm sure. And it was, you could tell it was so difficult for him to hear all these things, but it's something that, you know, he needed to hear, I'm sure. I do like what you said though about January Jones. I do think that this is a great scene to go to if you have always struggled with her acting performances, because I do think that she really, really nailed this hard. And it was really well done. Really well done.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's no surprise that I wasn't surprised at all about Don's initial reactions to the news and what he wanted to do. And I thought, of course, it was great to hear that she said, you know, listen, this is what's important. I need to be as normal as possible. And having him there would have not been normal. It would have completely messed up everything as far as how she visualizes the end to be for her. And she needed that. She needed to stay normal, and she needed to be able to know that things aren't going to be a huge, you know, change, especially with the kids' life, especially with the boys.
Yeah.
You know?
So what did you think about Betty's cancer storyline? Because I think it led a lot of people to sort of buy into this theory that people have had all along, that Matthew Weiner does not like January Jones, and so he gives her between like the fat Betty storyline and this thing. Do you lend into that theory?
No, not only because I've heard him talk so much about Betty in interviews and stuff. In fact, even his last big one that he had, he talked a lot about her. You know, Betty really does represent a lot about his mother, you know, and he sees his mother into her quite a bit. And I don't think that because she's had this rough road doesn't necessarily mean that that's because he hates her. I think that it became a very important character to him. Betty, I really think that she means a lot to him. And, you know, it took me by surprise. I can tell you that I was not necessarily expecting. I kind of felt really stupid about it because there was so many signs that were there that we should have known. And I know that he had mentioned in this final interview that he had said, you know, that he kind of knew right away early on since the pilot started with the death of her mother, that he felt like that this was a character that was not going to live long, you know. And I don't know why I never really saw that, but it took me by surprise. But, you know, I think that in the end I was able to look at it and go, okay, I can see this. I can see this being an ending for Betty.
Yeah.
But I think it is kind of funny. There's some major irony that the fact that the one character that a lot of people have struggled to like winds up being one of the last major characters we see that's going to get, you know, a shortened life. Mm. And I do kind of wonder a little bit about that, because it is kind of, the irony there is it's
oddly coincidental.
Yes.
I would say that, I mean, one of the things that I I actually really enjoyed about this is because I feel like Betty has been a little nebulous the past couple seasons. I mean, she really hasn't, aside from Fat Betty, we haven't had much to do with her except for her relationship with Henry. And I think this really gave her the opportunity to really be her own woman. And we talked at the beginning about how you said, you know, I think everyone's a little happier except for Betty. And I tried to kind of renege that statement because I think that she is happier. I think this is the person that we've seen, you know, the one who was shooting the gun in season one and kind of trying to go off and do her own thing. She's pursuing her own studies, which she's always wanted to do. And she makes, she's making the decisions in her life. And I think that's why I think the stuff last in the second to last episode, when, you know, with Henry demanding that she go through the surgery and her saying no, is so pertinent because she kind of has been defined by a man, by her relationship to a man for so long in her life, that to finally say, like, you know what, I'm going to make my own decisions here and say, you know, even though it's going to give me 6 months, I'm still going to make the most of my 6 months and do what I want and even tell her daughter, like, look, I'm going to do this, is so cool to me. And it's a nice little send off for the character that has kind of been maligned by both the public and, you know, characters on the show as well. It's nice to have her say, like, you know, F it. I'm going to do what I want now. I'm going to still smoke and I'm going to keep walking up those stairs until I collapse and die, because that's what I want to do right now.
Yeah, because she really did come into her own. She came to a place finally where she really is, like you said, happy. This is what she's always wanted to do. She went to go to school. And just because she hears this news that she doesn't have much longer to live, why would she stop now? You know, and I know she even says that. Why was I always going? Because she wanted to go. That's what she wanted to do. And there was no sense into her, you know, trying to do anything other than what makes her happy. And like you said, being able to make the decision. And also, too, thought it was really great that she didn't want to drag anything out. She didn't want her daughter to go through the same thing she did, which is watch, you know, her mother drag her death out even longer than needed. And so I thought it was just a very, very fitting, but it was a beautiful moment for Betty. And I thought the whole thing was cool how she handled it. I really did. And I thought, this is great. I walked away from a whole different feeling. By the end of season 7, I walk away with a completely different feeling about Betty than I think I ever would have a few seasons ago.
Yeah, I'd agree. I would absolutely agree with that.
And that's impressive considering, like you said, we've only saw so much of her, but the growth we were seeing was slow, and we had little signs of it, you know, whether it was her little conversation with her best friend, Francine, where she's talking about, you know, her life then, and just little things that we were seeing a little bit here and there that she was finally getting to a really good place. And so at least we know that she was in a good place before she goes.
So the vast majority of Dawn's storyline from here on out in the episode is going to involve Stephanie Draper, who we've seen in bits and pieces. We actually saw her most recently when she was pregnant and Dawn made her stay with Megan and that whole kerfuffle happened. Jeremiah, did you enjoy Stephanie's multiple appearances in this episode and how she kind of carries the weight of Dawn's storyline for the next several minutes?
Yeah, I'm okay with it because, listen, Stephanie represents that part of Dawn, that the part of Dick. And, you know, she is that connection there with Dick Whitman. And I think that it's very fitting that if there's going to be someone that's going to help bring him into this final moments, that Stephanie fit that mold very well. I mean, she just really meant something to Dawn, and she's very important to him. And it's funny because you could see that she doesn't quite understand it. You notice how she kind of had that conversation with him. I don't get why you're here. You know, you're not really my family.
Yeah.
But what she doesn't understand is that, you know, to Dawn, she's just as much family as anyone else is. Mm-hmm. You know?
Yeah. Absolutely.
And I think that I think she's a pivotal role for Dawn Draper, and because of his past, I really think that she really means something to him about that.
Yeah, it makes it hurt even more when she just takes off on him without saying goodbye. And I can make the assumption that he never sees her again, and that's the last time they sort of see each other. But it's also interesting to like see how much Dawn sees himself in Stephanie at that point when she specifically says, like, you know, my son's living with his father. I think that shows to Dawn, like, oh, you're just like me. Your kids are with their, you know, their birth mother or father too. That means that we can kind of be lone wolves and run off on our own. And I think that's sort of why she follows him. He follows her to that retreat, because he's like, oh, okay, I see a like mind in you. Let's go through this, you know, hoity-toity retreat together.
Yeah, I like that scene too, because I felt like she was about ready to leave without him. And then she looks down on him on the couch while he's laying there. And I think that she just thought to herself, no, he needs this just as much as I do.
Yeah.
You know, and it was good that it's her, because, you know, she does know. She knows Dick. She knows his story. And she knows him just as good as anybody else. So I think that was really important that she was the one to help get him to that point.
So I know we have seen No Megid for a few episodes now, but since there's a scene between Roger and Marie, and we'll talk more about Roger later, I kind of use Marie to talk a little bit about what are your thoughts in the use of Megid in the final seven episodes, or I guess is her last appearance in that one episode when she, you know, when they're taking out the furniture and she goes to meet Harry and Harry hits on her.
Yeah. And I believe that was New Business.
Yes.
Which if I remember right, that was the episode. Yes. Yeah, that was the final scene that we got to see from her. And Megid is an interesting character as far as that, you know, I think it's, I don't know, should we look at her as just another example of Don's failure as far as like trying to figure out what he really wants in his life, you know, especially when it comes to like relationships and things like that. I don't know if that is really what they want us to like walk away from with Megid. I mean, I know I definitely do have those feelings about her when I think about her character, you know, and I think that maybe, you know, she was very young and naive about a lot of things. And I think maybe she hadn't visualized that her relationship with Don would obviously go a lot different than it really did. We all knew who Don Draper was and that he was only going to like the beginning of it. And then at the end, it was going to fall apart. And poor Megid didn't know that. You know, if she would have had all she needed to do is have a conversation with Faye.
Yeah.
Maybe she would have maybe second guessed the idea of getting married to Mr. Draper.
Yeah, that's very true.
Yeah. So, I mean, at this point, I guess, you know, she's got $1 million check. What exactly she's going to do with it? You know, it's
Charles Manson.
Yes, exactly. So I just. She was very shy. I would be interested to see. So, I mean, do you have any more lasting moments or feelings about Megid?
I mean,
and her send off.
I mean, the point where Don writes her the check is so interesting to me, because it's not like she refuses it. And I think as we get later into the season towards the end, we start to see more and more people refuse Don's money, and Don starts to come to the realization of like, okay, maybe these people are not the typical strangers that I can kind of use money to buy off. We even see Diana's ex-husband as an example of that, where I think he offers to pay him for information and Don and the ex-husband just flat out refuses. But Megid is still the type of person that like will take the $1 million check and say, okay. But for a while back, Megid was the only real challenge to Don, you know, whereas like Betty, I think it was much more of a quiet, like divorce type of thing. And she never really fought back at him until after they were divorced. Megid was constantly like batting up against him, especially with that whole like, I'm going to LA now, I'm not anymore type of thing that happened at the end of season six, I believe. So I think she represented a lot. That being said, it was kind of sad to see her peter out so much and to have her only really appear for that one episode where it was like, oh, and she gets $1 million and then Harry hits on her. And it sort of leaves, I don't know if she's happier than she was at the beginning. I think she's in a much more tenuous position. I'm assuming she's going to keep acting, but I don't know. She may be, you know, taking more advantage of it. We may see her in Debbie Does Dallas in 10 years while Peggy's a creative director. Shows the disparity of you know, women in the workplace there. But I don't know. I was, for as much as they tried to put Megid into the zeitgeist of Mad Men for the past three seasons, it was a little sad to me that she really wasn't a part of those last like several episodes.
Yeah, I totally agree. But I think that if you look at the first half of season seven, I think that was kind of a long goodbye for us for Megid.
Yeah, you know, like that could be true.
You could and you know, they had so many different signs that you knew eventually it was leading to it, and it took a while to get there. In fact, I remember being frustrated watching season seven, going, "Come on, I know this relationship will work. What do we need it now? We need it now. No, now. You know, I kept waiting
and
for it.
And now.
Yeah, now, you know. And then we get all the way up into this episode in this season where we finally get that final closure where it's like, it's over. Here's your check. See you later. You know, and I am kind of, I have to admit, I do. She probably, if you'd ask her, of course she's happy. She's just got somebody write her a check for $1 million. But I am wondering, though, you're right, I could see her really heading down a bad path, because she kind of seemed to be a bit of a wreck at the moment that we finally see her. So that is kind of a sad moment. I suppose you could say that, you know, so much was invested in Megan, and that has to do with the fact that you could tell Matthew really liked the character a lot and really thought that she was a pivotal role for Don Draper, which she was. She did wind up being a very pivotal role for her, for his character. But yeah, I know what you're saying, though. It does kind of seem like that's, I can see how you look at it and go, wow, that's all we got from her. But if you kind of look at the season as a whole, at season 7, I think we did get enough of her to realize where things were going, and that it wasn't quite as sudden as we thought. I mean, the signs were there. We shouldn't, you know, we knew eventually it was going to happen, and it did. It did happen. But I can see how, though, because it was a year since we've seen the first half of season 7. So all we could see is this one episode.
Yeah. And I think it'll also be interesting to rewatch this show and watch season 7 as a whole, because delineated in such two big halves, and they aired a year apart, that I'm wondering, watching all the episodes at the same time, wondering how that's going to flow, as opposed to having to wait a year after Bert Cooper sings his song and to now come back into Ken Cosgrove being fired.
Yeah, I agree.
So let's do a little bit of a eulogy here for the brothers too, because Sally comes home to kind of, you know, she's the only one that knows about Betty's illness, or so she thinks. It turns out that Bobby, the walls are pretty thin in the Francis household, and Bobby was able to hear anything. We actually got a question here from Mike Toskas asking, just for whole time's sake, do you think they should have cast a new actor for Bobby Draper in the Mad Men finale? would you have enjoyed that, Jeremiah?
Why not? Why not? Wouldn't that have been, that would have been a nice homage to the show, which of course was an ongoing joke about every season there was a new kid that was playing Bobby.
I would have liked to see every shot a different actor. So they'll like cut to Gene and something, cut back to Sally, cut back to Gene to another kid.
Yeah, that would have been pretty hilarious, wouldn't it?
Yeah. Or if they put like, for one, they put like a grown fat man in like Gene's same clothes, or in Bobby's same clothes, and was just standing there.
Yeah, that would have been great. Yeah, I wonder about the decision. For those who probably don't know the story, was the young actor who was playing Bobby for the first season, there was like a big contract thing with him. And for whatever reason, his agent and his parents decided, you know, that they wanted more money and all this stuff. And like, they're like really trying to hold them over for more money and stuff. And of course, Matthew and I'm like, well, that's okay, we'll just get somebody else. And it kind of went through this like phase where they were struggling to try to find the right kid. And I started thinking to myself, boy, I wonder if the young man who was playing Bobby, which I don't know his name at the moment, I can't think of it off the top of my head, but I wonder if he's like really regretting just not saying, you know, taking whatever they were willing to give him to ride that out.
He's definitely the Pete Best of the Bobby Drapers.
Yeah, exactly. So we'll be interested to see what happens to that young man's career, and I wonder if he's going to be kicking himself for saying no to whatever that offer was that the Lionsgate and AMC offered him to continue on with the Bobby role.
He's I forget the name of the guy who was initially going to be Marty McFly and then passed up for Michael J. Fox, but he's definitely that guy. He's in the Hall of Fame with that guy.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
So we have this Roger and Joan scene, and I want to use this as to reflect more on Roger's story arc, because we don't hear much from Roger for the rest of this episode. But Roger basically comes to the apartment and tells Joan, I'm devising my will, and I want, not my wheel, my will, maybe his wheel as well. I don't know. Maybe he's trying to break the land speed record too. And he says he wants to leave a hefty amount to Kevin. And this is sort of their little final culmination where they sort of, you know, Roger talks about how he's going to marry Marie, and, you know, Joan says he finally got the timing right, which is a nice little nod to their tumultuous days in the first few seasons where they were together but not together. And we see it sort of in the, I think the main thing that we're getting from Roger is that Roger is learning to settle down, because we even got that in the scene where he was leaving Sterling Cooper, that he wanted to stay behind, and how he sort of realized like, okay, I just need to buck up and realize that like, I'm going to go to McCann. I'm just going to settle into things. I'm going to marry this woman and just spend the rest of my life with her. And that's that. Do you think that, did you find that an adequate ending for Roger's character?
Yeah, I think so. I do, because, you know, I like the way Jones said, well, finally somebody got the right timing. And I think this is the right timing for him, because he does seem to be very satisfied with where he is in his life. He understands who he is and where his place is and all this. And he's just completely content with where he's at. And I think Marie is such opposite of what he's ever had in his life before. And I think she's going to be really good for him. You know, she's able to like throw it back right in his face. And I just think that it was very fitting for him to end up with her. And this moment, of course, between the two of them was beautiful, because, you know, they've had such a long history. Joan and Roger had such a long history that, of course, many fans wanted to see them end up together. But I think we have known for a long time that was just not going to happen. You know, Joan had no interest in pursuing that much further than what we'd already seen her. She had made a point in her life. She decided, I need something, you know, I didn't need a Roger Sterling in my life. And I completely understand her. And she did not.
Yeah, she really didn't. And especially as we continue to see Joan's character mature too, and sort of, you know, when we get to the Jaguar stuff and even the things that happened in this half season with everything that was going on with McCann and the sexual harassment, I think we saw that, like, I think there's no way for Joan to go back to any of that stuff, be it a happy relationship with Roger. It's so interesting because Roger was the comic relief for so long, and he still kind of is, but it's interesting to have him settle down and have this more, like, you know, if Roger's been a curvy line for the other six seasons, it's interesting that he ends on a straight line note. And I agree that Marie is totally different from any other person that he's been with, even considering the previous scene that they had together. Like, again, sort of like Megan and Don, you know, Roger said, like, oh, you're forbidden to see your ex-husband. And Marie's basically like, screw you, I'm not. Go sleep on the couch. And I think that Roger never really received that from anyone he's been with. So I think, right. I think that's it's a nice person for him to be with. And it sort of keeps him in check a bit.
I agree. Yeah, I was very satisfied with his ending.
Yeah. And hopefully, I mean, Kevin will get a nice big sum of money from somebody that he barely remembers, which should be interesting.
Yeah, a little rich bastard.
Yeah, he'll buy all the oysters and vodka in the world so he can throw them up when he has to climb the stairs too.
Yeah, it certainly will be an interesting conversation, I think, at this point in his life when he gets that money.
So I'll skip over a little bit here. I want to get to one of the sessions that happen on the retreat. First off, the first session they do is very much actually reminiscent of an acting method called viewpoints, which is basically one of the exercises that you walk around the room. And I can't, when they started doing that, it harkened back to so much stuff that I did in college. But anyway, I want to flash to this other session where Stephanie is kind of divulging her, you know, she's talking her heart out. And there's that one woman who says, like, well, it seems like, you know, you want to go back to your child, and it seems like you're leaving your child behind, and your child's you're going to regret having your child look at the door every day waiting for his mother. And she sort of storms out. And this is where we get the big scene that we had kind of alluded to before, where Don gives his typical advice of, like, you can put this behind you. It will get better if you just move forward. And she just completely throws that advice out the window. She's the first person to do so and just says, no, I want to turn around and face this. And I think that's another big sign to Don of, like, well, maybe the Don Draper method of living isn't the way to live.
Yeah. And I really think that was extremely important for us fans, because we've been hearing Don Draper push this on so many people about, you know, just all you got to do is just move forward. You know, you will be surprised how much you'll forget, you know, as you move forward. And I think what Don is never able to really realize until this moment, when he actually hears Stephanie say it, is that, you know what, that might work for some things, but it doesn't work for everything, Don. And that there are some things in life where, you know, you just need to be able to face up to those things, because you're never going to be able to let it go, you know. And it was something that he probably may have never really thought about until she said it, you know. And I think it was like, you could tell the shock in his face. He was like, yeah. Whoa, wow. Okay, you know what? Maybe she's onto something here. Maybe there is things, you know, in my past that I really should stop this notion of just, like, you know, oh, I'm moving forward, I don't need to think about it anymore.
Do you think this propels him to call Peggy?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, definitely. Well, Yeah, I mean, I definitely think so. I mean, I think the whole thing with that, because she leaves, right? I'm trying to remember through this scenario here. She goes ahead and does, that's when the moment when she wakes up the next morning and leaves, right?
Yeah,
and
she goes to bed later that night. She says, like, I'll see you later at dinner. But she goes to bed, and then Don wakes up the next morning and she's gone. Okay. So this is basically the last time they talk.
So that's the last time they talk. And I do think between that and the fact that she does go and obviously leave to go pursue, I'm sure, to try to make amends of these things in her life. And I do think that because you could tell he was really broken with the fact that she leaves and doesn't say goodbye. And then that's when it hits him that one of the most important people in his life, and I'm sure that's what you're leading to, is that third phone call, that other really important woman in his life, he never said goodbye to. Mm-hmm. You know, and so, yeah, I think all that catapulted him to go to the phone to call Peggy.
Okay. I also just...
Is that how you felt?
I definitely feel the same way. I'm also, you know, I'm wondering how much... Yeah, I guess those last words did kind of resonate with him. I'm still trying to figure out exactly what propelled him to call Peggy in that moment. It might just be his low point once he saw that Stephanie was gone, which is basically what he considered the last member of family left, considering that Betty had told him like a day ago, stay away from me, that he's just trying to reach out for a hand in the dark. And that's where Peggy is. Speaking of Peggy, I want to talk briefly. We'll obviously talk about the big Stan thing later on, but I want to talk a little bit about this whole thing with Joan, where Joan kind of proposes to Peggy, let's come up with this. I don't know. Let's join this production company. What do you make of Peggy's ultimate decision to rescind Joan's offer? Is that an indication of her choosing her relationship with Stan over a job, or do you think it connects to something differently?
No, yeah, I think, well, I don't know. The way I looked at it was, is that I for sure, yes, she definitely contemplated. I think she was really interested in the idea. I do think, though, that her conversation with Stan did make her stop to think, obviously, that, okay, maybe this was more of me, you know, having an opportunity to be in control right away. You know, like, does she be able to jump right into a job where she would be in control? You know, and she's still a little ways away from doing that with McCann. But would she have been happy? You know, is that really what she wanted? And what she really, I think, wanted is, though, we heard those goals that she said to Don Draper a few episodes back, where she was going through her goals, and one of her goals is to eventually be creative director. And if she would have taken the path to be a partner with a production company, sure, would that have been a cool job? Would she would have kicked butt at that too? Just like Stan said, she's going to be great at whatever she does. But what is going to be the one thing that she's really going to be satisfied with? And to me, that satisfaction was more of, professionally, was about staying in McCann, you know, continue work through it, and eventually lead herself to a creative director, whether it's there in McCann or somewhere else. But to get to that point where she would get that cross off that goal that she has, mm-hmm. you know, and I think it's more of that, you know, I'm doing, because, you know, she could continue to have a relationship with Stan and not be working in a can, you know what I'm saying? Yeah. I don't think that really was it. I think it was just she realizing, okay, yeah, that's cool, but maybe this is not really what I wanted. This is what I want. Yeah. To be here.
Yeah, I think, and again, it connects back to that scene where, especially, I think the words were also harkening back with, again, that meeting she had with that guy who said, stay with McCann and you can go anywhere. And I think, as enticing as that Joan offer may be, and at the time when I was viewing it for the first time, I was like, oh, that'd be awesome. That's like, right. That's a total like fan fiction type of thing of like, wouldn't it be great if Peggy and Joan went into business together? I feel like that's absolutely not part of Peggy's trajectory. You know, I feel like she doesn't want to work on commercials, you know, she doesn't want to be part of like a production company. She enjoys the work that she's doing, albeit, you know, she might be in a weird position at right now, but if she's going to be creative director by 1980, she's going to be in a fantastic position.
Absolutely.
So I think, you know, and I think that was a big indicator. Plus, I mean, if she goes to work for Joan, she has to hang out with her kid, and we know how much she doesn't really like kids right now.
She struggles a little bit in that area.
Question about the kid. Can we put him in like the other room or something while we're working?
Yeah, I could just see her trying to work on something, and then Kevin's in the back, you know, playing with his toys, and she's getting a little aggravated. Yeah, I don't know if that would have been something she would have enjoyed. But yeah. I mean, she was obviously very honored and touched, though, that Joan reached out to her and only her to when it comes to offering partnerships. So they obviously have a very special relationship, and that whole thing was really nice to see that as we closed the season, the show up, it was really nice to see that between the two of them.
Let's talk some Joan here. And I want to kind of finish up Joan's storyline here too, because this is her like final scene.
She had a big moment in this finale. I mean, really, she was a big part of this finale.
Yeah, she had a big part, especially considering that she left McCann, what, like 2-3 episodes ago. She really has a big moment here. So this is the scene where basically Richard comes in and gives her the ultimatum of like, you know, it's
answer that phone
to take me or leave me, you know, answer that phone and I walk out of here. And she did. And she chose to go with the job. Now, I want to talk about this as a larger reflection of her storyline, which was like, it was almost like we could just say poor Joan and everything that was going on, because she is, I mean, poor Joan. She got sexually harassed and was basically forced out of McCann Erickson. You know, she was forced to take an offer and leave because she went to one guy and he hit on her. And then she said, I'm going to go to the boss, and the boss hit on her too. It was pretty disgusting to watch, in my opinion, but again, a reflection of the times. So do you think this is a happy ending for Joan, all things considered?
Absolutely. It's a happy ending for Joan because, you know, she has had an extremely rough road. Absolutely. And like I said, it's a sign of the times. It's something that I'm sure a lot of women were facing, that it was a great reflection on those things that women were facing at that time. And her and Peggy both, of course, represent this lifestyle. And the two of them took things in a whole, the two of them had different paths and how they got to where they were at, but they both, you know, had their own struggles about being a woman in the workplace and becoming, you know, who they were and who they would end up becoming. And what was, I thought, beautiful to see is that Joan is a person who is, she's just never going to get up and pursuing those goals. And she is, to me, at a beautiful point in her life where she realizes, you know, right now, what makes me happy is doing something, creating something, and still, you know, pursuing that dream of really creating something of her own. And I think the idea of her starting her own production company, to me, is just fantastic, because I don't, I said earlier, like I said at the beginning of our podcast, that I thought I would have been fine with her like running away with this Richard character and, you know, just having a nice simple life, you know, living on a beach somewhere,
doing cocaine
and watching Kevin play in the sand. But to me, this fits more of Joan's character, is because she was not going to take any crap, that she was going to make it happen, and she's making it happen, and she's continuing to make it happen, and she's doing it her way.
Yeah.
I loved it.
I agree. And I think it's such an indication too of like latter half of the series Joan. I feel like Joan in the first few seasons was like fine with the position she was in. I mean, she was like head of the secretaries, but I think once she saw Peggy kind of rise into her role, I think that kind of inspired her to pursue her own things. And I mean, we saw her whole arc with Avon, where she basically landed that account on her own. But and kind of in contrast with Peggy, where Peggy struggled initially, but then held a very tight role with the organization, Joan has really struggled to be recognized, to the point of where, like, you know, she like basically had to force her way onto becoming a partner. And, you know, she lost any account that she had. And it feels like she became like the a veritable Pete Campbell in terms of like every, you know, nobody would value her. And like she was basically at the butt end of every sort of deal that was going on. So I'm really happy that she was able to, at least for now, find a passion, and she's working on her own. And I think it's also really fun because I believe she's the only character that realizes like, I don't want to work in advertising, which, you know, I think it's a pretty, pretty surprising statistic, considering I'm assuming how many people in real life in an ad agency realize they don't want to work in advertising and leave. To have like only one of our main characters decide to actually leave the agency is pretty surprising.
Yeah, I mean, she's kind of, I guess her hand was kind of forced with everything that happened with the McCann thing. But that, with that being said, though, I do think you're right. It was kind of interesting. And she was one of the ones that realized, you know, I don't need to be in advertising. I just want to just do something cool and create something. I want to be part of something. And, you know, and I obviously she just like Peggy, to me, she's going to be good at no matter what she does as well.
Yeah,
you know,
I agree.
With that kind of drive that she has, she's going to be great.
Can you only imagine what sort of commercial she was going to make for Nathan's hot dogs?
That'd be interesting to see.
Yep. I can only imagine. Maybe she'll corroborate with Don after the Coke commercial to make, I don't know, what's another, they could have made the ring around the collar ad or the don't squeeze the Charmin ad. That could have been a Harris Draper collaboration there.
Absolutely. So,
let's talk about the Don and Peggy phone call. Because this has been one of the keystone relationships of the series in terms of Peggy becoming a mentee, manatee, mentos, whatever you want to call it, to Don. To have him call her and basically kind of spill his guts to her and say, you know, really show heart towards her, which we see in bits and pieces. We saw it in The Suitcase a little bit, which is, people argue, one of the best episodes of Mad Men ever. And to see it here, in my opinion, was so touching. And obviously it was going to come up as very touching as well. But to really have both the Don breakdown in this and just the line, like, you know, I realize I never said goodbye, is so sweet. And it's I feel like it's the perfect way to end that relationship on that note.
Right. Absolutely. I felt that way as well. I mean, that was a very emotional, one of the many emotional scenes in the episode that I was like kind of struggling with not to get too overly emotional about it. And because, you know, whether or not yet Don still wasn't able to recognize it, that she was showing how much that she cares and loves for this man. And it was so beautiful to hear because, you know, as she's talking to him, you know, first she's scolding him about, you know, where the hell have you been, you know, and everybody's looking for you and we care about you and all this stuff. And then when she realizes that Don's at a very low point in his life, and now she goes from that to being a very concerned friend, someone who, you know, she's like, you know, Don, God, he can't be alone right now. I'm getting really concerned about him. And it was just so beautifully done. I just absolutely loved every moment of it, and I even enjoyed it more rewatching through it again. It was just fantastic.
Yeah.
And I think eventually Don was able to go back to that conversation as well and recognize that is someone there, that the people there in McCann, the few there that know him, they do love him and care about him. So I did, the whole thing was just so well done.
And this is Don Draper, Dick Whitman at his lowest. He's the first, yes. He admits out loud for the first time ever, I messed everything up. I'm not the man you think I am. I broke all my vows. I've scandalized my child. I've taken another man's name and made nothing of it. And I think, you know, first of all, I think John Hamm needs an Emmy this time. I think it's been criminal that he has not won one so far. But I think of any of the scenes to submit, this is the one to do, because this is by far the most emotional we've ever seen John Hamm play his character on the show.
Yeah, we can make a fair argument about all the actors that did not get individual awards by the Emmys, but obviously
just want this to be a 4-hour podcast.
Yeah, but the fact that John Hamm has yet to get one was extremely disappointing. And I will be watching this September. I believe it's usually in September, right?
Yeah.
I will be watching and hoping and keeping my fingers crossed that Mr. Hamm finally gets that. And I would not be surprised at all to find or to learn that that will be his submission is this scene.
Yeah, well, I mean, we got to go back to the Steve Carell example. You know, Steve Carell didn't win for his final season on The Office. Who knows? John Cryer might submit for the finals for, you know, a dramatic series and win as well. So the Emmys are kind of a sham in a way. Speaking on the Emmys, I hope Mad Men picks up as much as possible, because especially with Breaking Bad out of the way, I think this final season has been, I've really enjoyed it, and I hope it picks up as many awards as possible.
I think it will. I think it will.
I don't know. Because what are like the other hot dramas going on right now? I guess Game of Thrones, but they barely win at the Emmys.
There's other hot dramas. I mean, you know, that you could make some fair arguments, I'm sure, about. But I do think it is possible that it's possible there's been a long enough drought for Mad Men now that where I could see them coming back and saying, okay, let's recognize the show again as being how great it was. Because as we all know, it's very political. The whole award system is very political, and it all has to do with lots of different things that's going on behind the scenes that none of us know about. But I could totally see them now going back to the well and then recognizing the show as great as it was.
All right, Jeremiah, you ready to talk about Steggy?
Yes, let's talk about Steggy, please.
So, I mean, I, this is the moment I alluded to before that I think people felt was a little rom-commy. to be fair, the dialogue is a little bit, specifically watching it the second time under that lens, you can kind of tell when they're like, I love you. And, you know, even Stan running in is like a little cheesy. But that being said, as a Steggy fan, I love it. And I loved that, you know, if we didn't get Joan and Roger, I'm glad we got Stan and Peggy.
Absolutely. I mean, I like I said earlier, I know I'm a bit of a sentimental, so I'm okay with all this stuff. I thought it was beautiful and I loved it. Was it a little bit on the nose, a little bit corny? I guess you can make that argument. I can understand why some of the fans.
But they're creative directors for an ad agency. They just talk and it seems like it's in the script, right?
But you know what though? They still, yeah, that's true. I felt like they still stayed true to the characters. I felt because the fact that Peggy, once she hears him say, "Hey, I love you," that the way how she had to work it through her own mind and the way Peggy works. And that to me, that completely fell in line perfectly with Peggy's character, right? The way she's like going, yeah, you know what? What the hell? I do love you.
Yeah, she basically, we just have like a minute long like stream of consciousness with Peggy where she's like, oh yes. My God, well, this is surprising. I mean, I don't know what to say because I want to strangle you, but at the same time, I miss you when you go away. Oh my God, I guess I'd love you too. Like that's literally the scene right there.
Right. It's like her working through a script, you know, where she's like writing it out going, yeah, that's how this should end. Exactly. I don't know why I didn't see this before, you know? And she's spoken like a true writer, I thought, is that she was, you know, it's been there the whole time and she just didn't see it until now. It's like finally somebody put it on the paper and she looks at it and goes, yes, that's right. I do love you, you know? And it was perfect for her. And I also thought it's Stan in line very well with Stan. You know, I think Stan's always known and just finally decided he was going to tell her. But it definitely was something that Peggy had to work through. And once she worked through it, she realized that, wow, this is something. What I thought was very interesting, Mike, is that I've seen this coming for a long time myself. I wasn't surprised at all that this was the direction that the two of them were going to end up. To me, they've been showing us signs that they were way more than just friends for a long time. I mean, I don't know about you, but there's not too many people from the opposite sex that I've spent on the phone just listening to them and not even like sometimes not even talking, just knowing that they're on the other line. You don't do that to your average friend. You do that to someone who you have an emotional bond with, someone that you really care emotionally about. And I think to them, the two of them just had to get to the point where they finally realized, hey, wait a minute, we really do love each other, don't we? And so they finally had that moment. And I thought that the signs were great. But the thing that I thought was interesting is that I was talking to my aunt yesterday, and she said she was actually taken surprised by it. She didn't actually see this coming. So I thought that was kind of nice and refreshing to know that not everyone, maybe not everyone was – there was a lot of people out there, fans out there, that maybe were a lot like Peggy, to where they just needed it to be said and then go, oh, yeah, OK, I can see this. Wow. Yeah, they do care about each other. They are in love.
Yeah, I'm sort of, I guess, in the middle of those two camps in terms of like I was hopeful it would happen, but I wasn't expecting it just because I think we saw, wasn't Stan like dating a nurse or something in this latter half, or at least I saw a couple of scenes in the bedroom of like him and a nurse. So like I was totally thinking like they're definitely going to end the series with like he just spends the rest of his life with the nurse and she doesn't and they remain friends. Like, again, coming from this perspective of what TV is kind of like nowadays, where it's a little darker and it's a little more grim, I was totally expecting that. So I was personally surprised to have it actually happen. Again, it was a moment of fan fiction I didn't think would actually come to become a reality.
No, I totally agree. I thought that there was a very good possibility that all we were going to be is maybe led in a direction to push it a little bit further, but not to the point obviously that we saw, but maybe a little bit to kind of like make you feel like, well, maybe with some time they'll get to a point where they realize that they really do love each other and they'll get together. To actually see it unfold on screen did take me a little bit by surprise, and I totally understand why some of the fans were going crazy about it, you know, because it didn't feel like it fit the show the way they expected it. But I liked it, and I definitely got emotional when I saw the two of them finally embrace. So call me a hopeless romantic, whatever, that's fine. But you're right, I think in this age of television, it's nice to have a little bit of that.
So let's move from one emotional moment to another. Let's talk about Leonard. Who Matthew Weiner has actually said in an interview is the most important character in the series. What do you think about that, Jeremiah?
Well, I think what he's trying to say is it was the most important character to Don Draper, because Don Draper needed to hear this from someone else, because this is how Don Draper, I think, has always felt. And I've been saying this for a long time, is that when you have someone who really never has had that, has never had the examples of love in his life. And when do you kind of, when you go through a life where love is not something you see or hear very often, because you're, you know, your stepmother is a terrible person, your father was a drunk, you know, you get raised in a horror house. I mean, this man has gone through his whole life not really getting to understand or recognize what love is and be able to accept it for what it is. And when he finally hears someone else say that, they also struggle wondering if there's people out there who are taking a pay attention to him, that notice him, that care that he's gone, and is able to hear all these things. And then you have this beautiful, by the way, this writing was fantastic. The explanation of the refrigerator thing, just what I heard, I was like, wow, I never thought of it that way. But that is such a great way to say that, is that sometimes when you're gone for a little bit and you come back and you wonder, wow, did these people actually miss me? Did they care about that I was gone and all these things? Are they excited to see me now because they've opened that door and there I am again? You know, I love that with some people. But I think so. The reason why he is so important is because of the fact that Don really needed to hear that from someone else, and it really touched him. And he was able to realize, okay, yes, there is other people who've had those questions about life as well.
Mm-hmm.
Is that how you felt? I mean, that's the only way I took away from it.
I think the most important part of it is that is his image as well. I mean, John, Don could think if another suit came in and said the exact same thing, Don could just
office.
It chalks it up to like, oh, just advertising guys feel that way. That's totally fine. I'll just leave advertising. But the fact that it's like a typical guy who works in an office, a suburban guy, a guy that Don would be marketing any sort of product to, is the one who's echoing the same feelings. I think that makes things so much more resounding. And in fact, I think it makes Don feel a little more human, because he thinks like, oh, okay, this isn't just something that the machine produced. You know, these are emotions that everyone, or at least certain people, are feeling. And I mean, this one line from Leonard that I really love is when he says, you spend your whole life thinking you're not getting it. People aren't giving it to you. Yes. Then you realize they're trying. You just don't know what it is. And I mean, going back to that Peggy phone conversation, you mentioned that, like, she said, she, you know, come back to the office. We need you. We miss you. And I think that's one of the moments when Don's things start resounding in Don's head. And he thinks, like, maybe they do, you know, people do want me, people do appreciate me. I just didn't realize it at first, because I was expecting something different out of that relationship.
Right. That's exactly right. And I think that when you see his expressions change as he hears him mention that exact line about, you know, not realizing where he's thinking that no one notices he's gone and realizes that, wondered if anybody even cares that he's, you know, gone. And I think that a light bulb comes off in Don's head, and he's thinking, well, you know, wait a minute.
Did the light bulb just go off because they opened the fridge?
Yeah, exactly. Because they opened the fridge. that moment where he realizes that's exactly what Peggy was telling me. Is Peggy's telling me that we miss you. We want you back. And that is it. That's the it. Is that, you know, you don't think about it a lot of times when people say those things, but those are those little things in life that will let you know about the ones that do care about you, the ones that are thinking about you. And, you know, sometimes people do struggle about being able to show signs of love and caring, you know, and I get that. You know, me and my wife talk about her grandmother was like that. She's the sweetest woman in the world, but, you know, she is not the kind of person who always would sit there and tell you, hey, I love you. But she would tell you in other ways. And sometimes you just have to pick up on those things. And sometimes those things are just hard to see, you know? Mm-hmm. And that I just think, yeah, all this accumulated into Don's head and realizing that there is people that care about me. And I just had, you know, it's just sometimes I just needed to hear it and understand that. Yeah, it's sometimes it's hard to recognize, but it's there.
Yeah. All right, Jeremiah, let's talk about this ending here. Let's talk about, I like to buy the world of Coke, the meditation things, all that. But the montage we talked about before, it's fun. It's something that's rarely done on Mad Men. This is drawn a lot of differing opinions. And actually, Aimlyn Shapiro has a question here where she says, why do you think that there are people who claim that the ending of the series was ambiguous? Because I think there is a good contingency of people that are saying, you know, was the commercial just shown, you know, when usually when they sing songs in the credits of Mad Men after the episode, it's not like we're to believe that Peggy sings the song, you know, she went on to write the song. But in this case, Don did write the ad for the Coke commercial that was shown at the end. Do you think there are reasons to find this ending ambiguous?
I think that anyone could... I think it's very easy for someone to look at it and say, well, this is so ambiguous, I can't tell for sure what exactly that meant when we see that. I mean, you know, Don has... It seemed like he was having some kind of light bulb moment, right? There at the very end, we even had the little ding and he's smiling. And then we cut to the commercial. So I can understand how a lot of people could have a lot of different feelings about this. And I think to me, it seems like what I've read is a lot of people wonder whether or not, though, does this mean that Don fully changed, though, or does this just mean that he came up with a new great idea for a commercial and he's still Don Draper?
Yeah.
And I think that is the ambiguous part of it, is that we won't really necessarily 100% know for sure. But I think that's what Matthew, of course, intended. He doesn't want us to, like, it's hard to say how much Don has necessarily changed in certain ways, but I do think that he is, and for myself, I think he landed in a happy place, and that I could see that this was the awakening he needed. But, you know, it's how much can Don Draper change? I guess that's the big question that a lot of people have. You know, yeah. is spending this time up there really going to be enough for him, right? Was this enough to change things for Don Draper as a whole, right?
Well, I think that it did. And I think because the fact that he goes back to McCann and writes the ad doesn't mean that he's reverting back to an old former self. Much like if we saw, like, you know, season 5, most of it Don was sort of on good behavior, and then we see that he goes back and starts, if you know, pulling down the Murphy bed with Sylvia in season 6. I think that the thing that people are confused about is, like, I think to them a sign of Don changing would have been him moving on to something else. But I think there exists a universe where he goes back to McCann, but he's still a changed man. He can still produce these brilliant ads. He's never stopped doing that. I think now he's mm-hmm. internally well. He's internally sound, and he knows that there are people out there who feel the same way as him, and that's going to reflect in his work.
Absolutely, yeah, because this trip that he went on, this road trip that he went on, there's another moment, too, I thought that was also important for him to hear, was that moment with those gentlemen in the previous episode where he was able to really let some of that stuff go that happened to him when he was in the military and the death of the real Don Draper and his decision to make there. I think it was something he really needed to hear, that a lot of these men, you know, a lot of guys had to do some things that, you know, normal human beings would have to do to make sure they make it home. And that was one of the things, is that he made that decision to take this man's life because he wanted to go home and he wanted to get out of there. You know, he wanted to go home and he saw an opening there to do that. And I think he really needed to hear that. So there was so much that he needed to do to get himself to where he's able to, I don't know, should we use the word forgive himself, or, you know, forget, be able to be okay with himself on all these things that he had mentioned in his phone call about that he, these terrible things that he did. I mean, I kind of feel like that is very important for Don Draper to kind of move forward, but I mean, be able to kind of forgive himself or be able to be okay with himself. Yeah. And I do think that was important. So what do you think? Is that okay to say that maybe he is finally at that point? Walk away from the finale feeling that way?
I mean, I think for me, it's more centric on connections. I think what he realized from talking about with Leonard is that connections are extremely important, and that he's kind of been going about the connections he's been making the wrong way between his family mm-hmm. and his lovers and his workmates. And I think he's able to forgive himself for, I don't know if he's able to forgive himself for that other stuff, for his past demons. But if this road trip taught him one thing, it's okay to kind of, you know, don't try to dwell on the past, which has sort of been his old motto since he took Don Draper's identity. I think he's now going back to McCann and he's thinking more about, like, the relationship and the connections I have with each people, which is why I personally think I'd Like to Buy the World a Coke is so fantastic of a finishing ad. A, because it's one of the most famous commercials of all time, and B, because it's all about connections. It's making connections with complete strangers across a varieties of races and sexes mm-hmm. and lifestyles. Mm-hmm. That's ultimately what Don does for a job, and now he knows the key to making those connections.
Yes, exactly. Well, because once he understands those connections, you're right. He was able to come up with this, and I think you're right. That's beautifully said.
So let's dive into we have a few more listener questions to kind of just give our final thoughts here on the series. So Dave Backer asked, looking back on all the characters, who do you think is the most primed for success at the end, and who had the most growth and who grew the least throughout the course of the entire series? So let's take the first question. Jeremiah, who do you think, looking at all the characters and their final point of the montage, which one do you think is going to become the most successful?
I'm going to go with Peggy Olson.
Okay. I could definitely see that.
You could definitely make a fair argument with just about all of them, really, because if you think about it, most of them are on a path of major success. And even Ken Cosgrove is, you know, big man over there with Dow. So, So I think you can make a fair argument for everybody. I like to believe that it's going to be Peggy. Because I think that she has these goals that she wants to reach, and I think she's going to reach them. But I certainly think you can make a fair argument for everybody.
Mm-hmm. I would agree with that. I think that, I think Don is sort of in the Roger position where he's going to be, I think he's going to be very complicit with his role now at McKen, especially now that he has Coke. I think now that he realizes what he's kind of going back to his job with a new purpose, I think he's totally going to be staying in the job. He's not going to try to, you know, be two passing ships in the night like he does before with these impromptu road trips. So I think he'll be totally fine. He has enough success as it is, but Peggy has been alluded to as like this person that really just is going to keep climbing through the ranks. And I think as it gets into the 80s and the 90s, which would be weird to have Mad Men in the, you know, scenes in the 90s with Mad Men. Right. But I think Peggy, especially, you know, once women in the workplace becomes more of a big thing, I think that she's really going to make a big splash in the world.
Yeah, exactly. That's my thoughts too, because you're like, Don is already a legend for the most part, and even if he goes back, you know, he's working McCann and he's going to continue to make awesome, amazing ads. But he's kind of already arrived there. But Peggy, on the other hand, is still working to that point, and I think eventually she's going to get there. And I just think that. But certainly, like I said, you could certainly make an argument for people like even Joan. You know, but I could totally see her be a huge successful, turning that production company into something gigantic and her being a big name.
So
I totally see that.
Michael Rivera has a fun little game for us to play, a nice little word association game, as if we're in, you know, Faye's little psychological sessions here. So I'm going to give you a name, and we're each going to give one word to describe each of the following characters. Are you ready to do this, Jeremiah?
I did see this question, and I'm hopefully as ready as I can be.
All right, so let's start with Don.
Okay, Don, I went with rigid.
Rigid, interesting. I'm gonna go with, looking back on his entire character, I'm gonna go with enlightened.
Okay, that's actually probably even better. Well,
thank you.
You're welcome, sir.
Starting off on a high note, so that once my dictionary starts disappearing as we get through, don't expect it. I might use enlightened a few more times throughout as a spoiler. What about Betty?
My first word that came to me was tragic, but I don't know if that's the right word to even use now that me and you've talked about it. But that was the first one I wrote down. What comes to your mind now?
I'm thinking unfettered. Especially after what we talked about, unfettered is in like, you know, unchained, unbound, because I think that, again, she has been so shackled into these sort of roles of domesticity, to have her kind of, even though she has, again, 6 months to live, to kind of break out of her shell and say, like, I'm going to live the rest of my life the way I want to, is a definitive statement considering the what we've seen before of her.
Yeah. And exactly. And I was thinking, after we've talked through this, I think I like that a lot much better.
What about Sally?
I want strong.
Strong, yeah. Strong is a good one. Let me think of one. I would probably say, I almost said enlightened again. Let's say knowledgeable, just because I think she, maybe not in the level of enlightenment as in like she knows all about the world, but she knows more about the way the world works now than especially what she did when she was a kid. But even in her teenage years, when she was, you know, sneaking out to not go to people's funerals to spend a day in the city. I think this is a different Sally now.
Absolutely.
What about Roger Sterling?
I wrote down content.
Content is a good one. I like that.
Yeah, he just seems like that's where I feel like that's where we leave him.
I'll say relaxed in a very similar manner. I think that I think that he's very like he's fine where he is, which is very atypical of Roger. How about Joan?
Yeah. I wrote down driven.
Ooh, yeah, that's a good one. I'll go with something similar. Maybe I'll say like I don't want to say productive. How about oriented? I think she's been pointed towards the thing that she really wants to do now. She has all sorts of obstacles out of her way, and now she can actually do it.
Yep, I like that.
All right, Pete Campbell.
this is the first thing that came to my mind is lucky. He finally got lucky. I mean, you know, this man has wanted, there's so many things he won in his life and he struggled so much to get it. And then he finally gets it. So he finally has his lucky moment where everything kind of falls into place for him. You know, the perfect job. He gets his family back. He's going to be king of Wichita. And, you know, sometimes you just need a little luck in his life. But I think he finally got that.
Yeah, I'm going to be cheat a little bit and use like a hyphenated term. I'll use rags to riches because I do feel a very similar way of like, I think to begin with, he wasn't, you know, a pauper, but I think he was sort of at the very bottom of the Sterling Cooper totem pole.
The rags to rich of his career. I mean, I know what you're trying to say.
Not poor and now he's rich because I think moving to Wichita is sort of the opposite effect of that. Now that Pete isn't a landlord anymore, we missed out on Col Campbell. I want to see now the spinoff where he's a farmer.
Yeah, that would be, wow, that would be quite a change.
I have to live on a corn farm?
Yeah, I think the biggest concern I have for poor Pete is that he's not going to get good bagels at all in Wichita. I can't imagine him.
What's a bagel?
I have a feeling in 1970 in Wichita, I don't know how much people are talking about bagels there, but no. Hey, maybe I could be wrong. I don't know.
Who knows? If there's a listener from Kansas and wants to send us a picture of their local bagel stand, let us know. Let's go. What is your word for Peggy?
Persistent.
Persistent. Oh, persistent's a good one. I would say balanced. Because I mean, I think Stan made a really good point to Peggy when he said, you know, life isn't all work, or maybe I'm paraphrasing him there.
Something like that. Yeah.
Yeah. Something like that. And I think that's, there's more to life than work is what he says. And I think that is like the goal that Peggy wanted to get to, because that's her entire struggle. The entire series is like, once she finds that job, then she tries to bring in all these different guys, but they can't really mesh with her work lifestyle. And this is really the first time where she can really make life her work and have a love at the same time. So I'm glad she's finally balanced. Ken Cosgrove.
You know what? I'm going to stick with kind. I wrote down kind because I still think that despite the fact that he, you know, got his little revenge moment and took the road that I thought was probably not the one he should have gone, I still think he's a good man at heart. I do think that he's still a sweet, kind person, despite, you know, the things that we saw here towards the end. So I'm going to stick with that for Ken.
I might be misusing this term, but voyeuristic, I guess, referring to, you know, how he, I think he's very resourceful, and I think he's able to use a lot, you know, he was able to leverage getting out of getting fired from Sterling Cooper to become the main person at Dow. And he was able to use Joan for that connection to get, you know, to boost his own image with Dow with the whole industrial ad. So I think I agree. I don't think Ken is a mean person. I think he got his one little poke, especially, you know, when he sat down at that dinner with like Roger and Pete, and he was clearly bothering Pete so much. And that was a really fun scene to watch, but I think he's okay now. Let's talk about a guy that we really haven't seen that much. Harry Crane.
I wrote down pompous.
Pompous. I'm going to,
or you could probably also go with maybe selfish maybe, or
yeah, pompous, selfish. I'll give off, I'll give the word butt monkey.
Because
I mean, you know, it's the term that you give to like the Jerry Gergich from Parks and Rec, or like Toby from The Office, of like the guy that like everyone just kind of craps on. And I feel like even though Harry has really carved a name for himself, he was the one to say we need a TV department, and he's
a smart guy. Yeah.
Yeah. I just think that nobody takes him seriously. And even after all these years.
That's true. I think they do kind of struggle to take him seriously, but yeah, there's probably some other adjectives I could have used, but we're trying to make this a family friendly podcast here. So
what about the late Bert Cooper?
I wrote down legend.
And should I write down dairy?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah,
but you have to put wait for it in between there.
Wait for it in parentheses. I would have to put Wizened or Wizened, I'm not sure how it's pronounced, but it's, you know, it's sort of like he's almost like the Gandalf-esque or Dumbledore-esque figure, because he seems like all-knowing, obviously for the fact that he's elderly as well, but he always seemed to be like the guiding light with Sterling Cooper, even in, you know, Roger was so much younger than him, but he was, in spite of them being like equals on the naming front, he was still like the source of things. You know, when he usually said something, it was usually law. So I think that Bert was a huge influence on the series in general. And looking back, doing a rewatch of the series is going to be really interesting to see what Bert Cooper's role is throughout.
Mm-hmm. Oh, absolutely.
Another person that was not featured so much or at all in the final episode, Megan Draper, nay, what's her maiden name? Something French.
Oh, Megan's maiden name. Oh my gosh. Yes. Oh man.
It's like Couveau or something like that.
Yes, I know. My gosh, I can't. I'll think of it. But Megan was one I struggled with a little bit when it comes to trying to figure out one word to describe her. Really did struggle with this one. I kind of was thinking like I was leaning towards like a word like naive or something like that, because she's still so young and she still has so much to learn. I don't know if that is the right word to use, but it's one, like I said, she's one I really struggle with. What do you think about Megan?
I was going to go with feisty, because I think though she is feisty. Naive, I mean, she again puts up a lot of a fight, both with Don and her mother and Harry, like, you know, and even when she was working the beat out in Los Angeles, she was like confronting casting directors in the parking lot for not getting parts. And by the way, I just looked it up. Her maiden name is Calvay.
Yeah. Calvay. Me and you were doing the same thing. I was quickly looking up too. Yes. Yes. How can we forget that last name?
And to finish off, someone who also was not in the finale, but was very prominent in the previous episode, Henry Francis.
Yeah, I know. That's another one. It's really hard to like think much about. I mean, Henry was obviously a very important character for Betty. I mean, that was her solid there towards the end. But I just think of sadness when I think of poor Henry now, you know, because he's left without someone, you know, he's left without his wife that he loves so much. So I was just thinking of just the word sad, but I'm sure that probably really didn't describe him very well, but it did describe the feeling I had when I think of him now.
I'm going to use the term bombastic or decision maker, because
that's true, he was because
watching, I mean, he's a politician, but B, watching him kind of carry that into his relationship with Betty was really interesting too. I mean, you have that scene in the first half of season 7 where he kind of admonishes her for like talking about the war, I think, at a party with his colleagues, and then even here when he's saying like, you're gonna go and get this treatment and get the surgery in order to be cured. I think he's just very used to making all the decisions because that's part of his job, that it sort of bleeds into his private life a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely right. So no, I like that. I think it works perfect.
So we have one more question from Michael Rivera, and I think this is going to be a great way to kind of wrap up our thoughts on the series overall. What impact did Mad Men have on TV, and will we see another show like it soon? So Jeremiah, can you answer that question and sort of tie in your final thoughts about Mad Men, the series, into it?
I think it's a great question. I do think it's one of those that I will probably dwell about for a while and maybe even change my answer as time goes on. But I really feel like that it's going to have a major impact, I think, in television. It is a very different kind of show, though. It's, as we mentioned earlier, you know, it's not much as about the plot as it is the characters. It was a show that was so heavily held on their themes. And it's one that you certainly It would be very difficult to repeat, I think, to do something like this. It is, I think he even in his post on this, the one that he did on Facebook, I even talked about whether or not, you know, this is a show for TV snobs. And I do think that, you know, there's a certain type of television viewer that likes the show Mad Men. This is not a show definitely that's for everybody. It's certainly extremely, it's a smart show. You know, it's written so smart. And I don't think that you could successfully pull it off very much. But when Mad Men came on the scene, the world was kind of looking for that next special show, you know, because The Sopranos had been wrapping up, and that show obviously did change television, I feel. To me, it does. I mean, there's some other great examples like Lost and some other shows that really changed the way I looked at television. But Sopranos was definitely one of those shows. And when it ended, we were kind of looking for the next Sopranos. And obviously, Mad Men is not the Sopranos, obviously. But it took us to a new type of television. I think that a lot of viewers were very, I think we were finally accepting of it. You know, I don't know as television viewers we were ready for that. You look at the history of television and how much it's grown to where we are today. I think it is the best it's ever been, you know. And I do think that the cable TV is what changed that for us. And it was obviously, as we mentioned earlier, this was a huge, big success and opening for the television, for obviously AMC. And I do think it will be remembered as one of the greatest TV shows to ever be written, you know. And I mean, it may not be on everybody's list, but I think I wouldn't be surprised to see it be on most people's top five list of some of the greatest TV shows of all time.
Yep. I believe in Entertainment Weekly, they made like a big best of list a couple of years ago. I believe it finished like number five, I think, of best TV shows ever.
It did. It finished very high. I don't remember. It might have been number five now that I think about it. And I think even now that it's over, I think people are still going to feel that way. I think it's still going to be on the top of their list. But it would be extremely difficult to repeat something, at least on that same level.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? But I definitely think that people have learned from this and learned that viewers can and will accept, you know, the type of writing that this has. I think they really can accept this a lot more than maybe what we originally thought it was. Matthew went all out, and I'm glad he did, because it really made me look at the way things are written way differently than I ever had before.
Yeah. So I just checked. Mad Men finished number nine, which again, compared to all the shows throughout all of time when this was published, is pretty
huge.
Staggering.
Yeah, to be in the top 10, that's fantastic. And like you said, we'll see if they ever reevaluate it again. Maybe it'll even go a little bit higher, depending on how they feel about the way it ended.
So I'll say that, appealing to Michael's initial question, I mean, I think the impact that, you know, Mad Men had on TV, and we'll see another time soon, is actually very reflective now. I mean, let's remember things like the Playboy Club and Pan Am, when people realize, like, oh, nostalgia is a huge selling point. So even just from that perspective, I think the nostalgia factor has a huge effect on television now, with a lot of, you know, even something like The Americans, which takes place in the 80s, it still has that nostalgia factor that Mad Men brought there. And speaking from a broadcasting perspective as well, I think having it be such a huge hit for AMC, a network that had done nothing in terms of programming beforehand, sent a message to a lot of basic cable channels to say, like, hey, look, if you can bring quality programming here, you know, just because it's not NBC or CBS or Fox or ABC doesn't mean that you can't, you know, pick up good critical reception for it. And so it really, it's like, you know, the little underdog story in lieu of all the big network shows. And it goes to show now, I mean, thinking about like last Emmys, you know, how many shows were nominated that weren't in broadcast networks and not HBO. There's a good amount of them. And I'll say overall, and I don't know if Mad Men is the one to pioneer this, but I think it goes in lines with a lot of these shows like The Wire and 6 Feet Under, in terms of Mad Men is a show that allows viewers to just take a breath and watch what's going on. I think nowadays, this is the golden age of television, but there are so many series that are all about, like, okay, what's happening? Who's, you know, there's action scenes, and then there are screaming scenes, and, you know, political unraveling, and lots of family drama and everything. Mad Men is a show that's much more simple. It's one that will say you can just watch an hour of these people just in different business meetings and handling different sorts of relationships, and that's still going to be as captivating as what I just described. And I think that's very hopeful for future TV makers to say, like, okay, if people are really interested in that, they're interested in just watching people. They don't need big government plots. They don't need giant mysteries. They don't need, you know, celebrity guests. All they need is just captivating characters interacting with each other. And I think that's ultimately the legacy that Mad Men leaves, which is that it's a phenomenal show, in my opinion, that is just so simple and is beautiful in its simplicity.
I agree 100%. And you did a very good job explaining that, because I think that me and you, if we wanted to, like you're talking about the influence, you're right. We could probably sit here and probably think of all kinds of different shows and different networks that once they saw the success that AMC was able to have, that they were able to do the same thing. And I think you can make a fair argument that some of the big hits that we have right now on some of these other cable networks that we're not doing television, we would not have them today if it wasn't for Mad Men. And I think that's a great honor to what you said there, is when people look at what is the impact that it's had. I think that will definitely be it. And you're right. Hopefully maybe this will open up the world of television to realize that you don't necessarily need all these big plot points necessarily. If you just have amazing characters, rich characters that we can all get really invested in and care about, that's all you need.
Yeah.
And it certainly was an homage, obviously, as well to advertising and obviously the 60s. And I do appreciate that as well. So I think it was a perfect combination. It would be very difficult to duplicate, but who knows? Maybe we will see a show very similar to it in the near future that actually succeeds. Because I know there has been some attempts at making a show like Mad Men. It hasn't really worked quite yet, but eventually maybe somebody will come around and do something.
Jeremiah Panhorse, thank you so much for coming on to talk Mad Men with me for 2+ hours at this point. This is
the longest Mad Men podcast ever
on the channel, at least until, you know, one, maybe we'll do a series rewatch one day and they'll take up a huge chunk of time. But I mean, I always love talking with you, and this is clearly a show that you absolutely love. Can you give out your Twitter handle and also plug your, even though Mad Men's over, you have a pretty big Mad Men podcast on your own, correct?
Yes, I do. It's my little baby. That's my little thing that I've had here for the last 5 years. I cannot believe I've been podcasting for 5 years. It goes by so fast. That's all I can say. But yeah, I've been to madmenpodcast.com. It's been quite a joy that I've had. We definitely are planning on, I'm not ready to let it go to bed yet. I mean, obviously we're going to continue to keep doing a few things over there for a while, and how much longer I will continue to talk about Mad Men, it depends on myself. I think I want to get, as long as I'm still passionate about it, I certainly would like to, you know, explore some of those more deeper subjects and as we go on, as the show has now ended. But certainly, definitely check it out at madmenpodcast.com. You can follow me though on Twitter at @jpanhorst. That's JPANHORST. And by all means, anytime, hit me up. I love, still obviously love talking about the show. And it's been an honor, Mike, to do this with you, my friend. Oh. This has been a real treat for me because I'm a huge fan of you and your work. And it was just a delight to find out that I was going to have the opportunity to work with you.
The honor is all mine. And thank you. I guess in your eyes, I'm much more the sriracha than the Dijon mustard.
That's right.
You can always find me on Twitter at @AMikeBloomType. And I'm always doing things here on Post Show Recaps. Right now we're doing weekly recaps of Orphan Black with Jessica Leese. We're in the back half of the season and things are just getting started and how interesting they are. If you are a Once Upon a Time fan and you haven't listened yet, Kirk Clark and I did a feedback show to sum up the season, the recently wrapped season last week. I also did a recap with AJ Mass covering the first 2 episodes of the new Fox show Wayward Pines. And I did a couple of recaps this past weekend talking with Josh Wickler about some Lost. So there is a lot of stuff to check out in addition to our fantastic coverage of Game of Thrones, as well as SNL's finishing up as well. Orange is the New Black is coming up. So as we approach the summer months, there is plenty to check out here on Post Show Recaps. So to finish things off, let's see if we can come up with a hashtag for people who have made it all the way through this podcast.
Dijon mustard.
Could be Dijon mustard. I also have a hashtag shed the fur coat.
Ooh, I like that too.
Maybe you want to go with that one? Or
Yeah,
so we can go with that one. You could do hashtag Dijon mustard if you'd like to. But
we'll accept either one. But yes,
or hashtag shed the fur coat to allude to not only the characters doing so, but I guess AMC is sort of shuffling off its moral coil here and ending the end of an era with Mad Men. Jeremiah, again, thank you so much for coming on. Thank you guys so much for listening. This has been fantastic to talk about. Maybe we'll talk about Mad Men in the future. Who knows? It's a big wide world out there, and I don't know about you, but I am thirsty for a Coke. So thanks so much, yes. Everybody. Take care, everyone. Bye-bye.